Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight's topic is the films of Quentin Tarantino. Well, not just the films, but the whole career of Quentin Tarantino. And toward that end, we have with us four guests. So, in order, say hello, Sydney Dizino.
Hello.
We have Gregory Runfeldt. Say hello.
Hello.
Perry Seibert.
Wiggle your big toe.
And Aaron White.
Hello.
Yes. So, you know, we always start out with this question. And I will just jump in. You know, I mean, let's do what Tarantino always does, nice quick beginning to the show. How did we first come to Tarantino? Gregory?
In a rather predictable fashion for me personally, in my story, is rather predictable. Just 1992 or 1993, or like the year, a few months after it came out, I rented Reservoir Dogs on video, you know. And I recall my cousin Susan talking about the film. She's like, "It's so violent, Greg. Oh, my God. Oh, my God." So, you know, naturally, you know, I'm like, "Ooh, that sounds good," right? So, you know, so I go to see it, you know, I rent it. And now this, it was a VHS copy, so it was pan and scan, which was nothing I could do about it at the time. But, you know, I remember watching it, and I'm like, you know, this is a really fascinating little film, you know. And it is violent, but it's not like continuously violent. There's only like spurts of violence in that film, so it wasn't like the most violent film that has ever been made, like my cousin had suggested it was. But that was the first time, and then the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, now people made way too much of the violence in Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, but we'll get to violence in Tarantino a little later in the show. So, Perry, what about you?
I was a sophomore in college in 1992 when Reservoir Dogs played the Michigan Theater, and it was all anybody in the film department wanted to talk about for the 2 weeks it was in town. We talked about that film endlessly. I remember sitting down with a couple of people trying to dissect that final shootout and realizing that Mr. White gets off two shots. We were in love, and then that was it. That was, yes, I've been in from day one.
So, Sydney, you?
You know, I was actually trying to think today, like, which, because there's two movies that I don't know which came first, but I don't know if I saw Pulp Fiction first or if I saw Kill Bill Volume 1 first. But I saw them around the same time, because one led to the other in some way. I don't know if I saw Pulp Fiction because Kill Bill was out in the theater and I wanted to know what he was all about, or if I saw Kill Bill and then I wanted to go find out what else he did. I don't know which order I saw it, but I know I did end up loving Kill Bill so much. That was like my first love. So that might have been the first one I saw.
You know, now that you mention it, I remember you when...
I'm going to say, do you remember at all me mentioning it?
Yeah, I remember the for about a month or two there, it was like, oh my God, I went back to the theater, I saw it again. I was like,
I saw it like eight times, and then I rented it, and then I bought it.
Yep. And you're like, when is the sequel coming? And I was like, next year. It can't come fast enough.
I know, and out of the two, to be honest, I know you're supposed to like look at them as like a whole movie, but I will still just watch the first one over and over again. The second one's good. It ends the story, but that first one is better.
I contend it does not end the story, but we'll get on to that.
Yes, and that brings us to you, Aaron. So what about you? What was your first?
My cousin had a similar experience to Sydney with Kill Bill Volume 1, and I was over at his house, and he had rented it for like the 6,000th time, and I had not seen it. And he put it in, and we watched it, and I was thoroughly amused. And then he came over like a month later, and we rented the other three movies that Tarantino had done up to that point and watched through those in a weekend. And then I went to see Kill Bill Volume 2 in theater, and that was kind of it.
Yeah, I saw Kill Bill 1 and 2 in the theater and loved them. But my my first Tarantino, the first one that I saw that was the Tarantino had anything to do with, that I was aware that his name was in the credits and everything, was True Romance. But then I had a friend that said, "Hey, you've got to see this guy's movies," because at the time he'd done Jackie Brown, Pulp Fiction, and Reservoir Dogs. And I said, "Yeah, well, let me borrow them," because he had copies of them. And he was like, "No, you come over and you watch them in order." So I proceeded to see at my friend's house over a period of about 2 days, Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and Jackie Brown. That's my story. So, you know, Tarantino, you know, he's done both movies and television. We'll get into some of the TV stuff that he's done, the episodes and other things. But, you know, let's ask this question. People talk about the violence in the movies, and we'll delve into that a little more deeply. But does there appear to be any single overriding theme or themes throughout the 9 movies that he's both written and directed? I will start with you, Perry.
If I'm going to pick one, I think he has, and I think this is a holdover from him and his, his absolute love of old-fashioned novel noir. He's obsessed with the past and how it plays on the present. I think that's the unifying factor for all of them, in both big and little ways, in grand sociological ways, and in just smaller interpersonal ways. And I know that sounds really generic, but I really think it's true. And I think that is the one absolute unifying factor, you know, outside of an obsessive love of popular culture.
Almost seems like he and Linklater might have some things in common in that way. Interesting.
Coming at it from very different angles. But yes, that's an interesting one to suss out. Yeah.
Yeah, because Aaron and I have discussed many times over the years the way that Linklater is probably the most incisive explorer of the effects of time of any director in the last, like, 40 years.
Absolutely.
So, Gregory, what about you?
Now, the question, you mean just in terms of the violence that he shows or his attitude, or just like whether he has like an overall point of view, you know?
Well, like the thing is, like I said, we could consider, you know, violence as part of it, you know, that's your thought. But the question specifically is, does there appear to be an overriding theme or theme in his films?
Okay. I don't really... Because a lot of people have said, like, he has this, like, bleak view of people. I don't think he really has any view at all. And that he's just making films that, you know, he's kind of remaking the films he grew up with that he liked, like the Grindhouse pictures, the B-movies, but the films that were made in Western Europe that weren't, like, the famous art films, like the like the popular entertainments they used to call them, like the films of like, you know, Sergio Corbucci, for instance, right? You know, his westerns, or like, of course, the film Inglourious Basterds, which he, you know, by Enzo something, I can't remember the director's name, but, you know, he lifted the title for the film and then misspelled Bastards as well. So I think that's really what he does. He's kind of somebody, a friend of mine called him like a patched artist, right? Where he just takes one thing from one film, something from another film, and he just weaves it into like something that he likes, you know? So I don't think there's like this overall, like some, like when you would talk about Stanley Kubrick and you would say he has a bleak, ironic view of man, or he's a misanthropic person, you know, with his films, which I don't think that's actually true, but, you know, that's another topic. But that, you know, people always generalize about Kubrick that way. So with Tarantino, I don't think that there really is like a, like an overriding theme of his movies. I just think he's like, you know, goes in there, watches some of his favorite films, and it's like, oh, here we go. But having said that, there was always that accusation that Reservoir Dogs is a ripoff of City on Fire, a Ringo Lam Hong Kong picture from a few years before, and that's not actually true. I've seen City on Fire, and there's some similarities thematically between the two pictures, but Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs is much more, you know, it's told in a much different way. You know, the flashbacks, much more dialogue-driven, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So,
yeah. So, what about you, Sydney?
I actually thought about this for a while, and I came up with the fact that I think they're all in some way about revenge, whether directly in the plot itself, like Kill Bill, come on, that's all revenge. Inglourious Basterds, revenge. Django Unchained, revenge. You could even argue Reservoir Dogs is just, they're all like one-upping each other the entire time. That's like many forms of revenge. Every single plot of all of them is, and that's where the violence comes from as well. Like, it's this cathartic relief, revenge fantasy that he just plays out over and over again, and I think that's why the movies do so well, because, you know, we all kind of want to, you know, chop someone's head off with a katana sometimes in our head. Or shoot a house full of racists. Like, wouldn't we all want to do that someday? Like, or kill some Nazis? Wouldn't that be fun?
Oh yeah.
And like that, like there's some wish fulfillment happening with his revenge fantasies, and I think that's why it does so well.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about you, Aaron?
I was going to say revenge with the capital R. I think Sydney made my points. I'm going to touch more on this with Kill Bill specifically, because I think it's where it's most obvious. But I think it's in all of his films as well, and that's the corrupting nature of violence.
Yeah. No, and,
it all,
you know,
kind of starts, every storyline starts that way, isn't it? Like, they're getting revenge because of some unspeakable act upon them.
And I think that, you know, the connection between revenge and violence and hate, you know, that's why, you know, a lot of people prefer his earliest works. But in a way, I think his later works, they may not be as fun in some ways, but I think that he's, in a lot of ways, he's matured in terms of the way he explores those themes, particularly Django Unchained, which I think is one of the more profound explorations of the effects of violence in the last 20 or 30 years in film. But we'll get to that a little more. So my next question is, you know, Gregory said that people call him a patch artist, and people have always said, well, yeah, he just steals this and steals that, and it's all homage and this and that. Well, you know, I think a lot of the way we think about Tarantino is based in the initial response to Tarantino rather than the reality of the man. And people have continued to ignore him and his evolution in order to try to fit him into the initial narrative of his first two or three films of his early career. So to that end, I want to ask, what or who seem to be his biggest influences? I'll go with you, Gregory. Who do you think his biggest influences are?
excuse me. Like I had mentioned before, I think that kind of, you know, the grindhouse films that I remember when he became well known, he reissued several films that came from that, like, I guess, genre, you know, for lack of a better term. One was Lucio Fulci's The Beyond. One was Sonny Chiba's The Street Fighter. And actually, Sonny Chiba, he just passed away about 2 days ago.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, and Switchblade Sisters, right? He also had that released under his Rolling Thunder Review, like, distribution company. So I think those are, like, the films that really seem to influence him and that he just keeps going back to that well. But having seen, like, some of those films, I actually think that his dialogue I think his films are actually better than those grindhouse films. Because I watched Switchblade Sisters, and honestly, I thought it was extremely boring and just very poorly acted. But then, you know, it was a low-budget 70s film, so a lot of times the acting is always very highly variable in those pictures anyway. But I still didn't like it very much. But I think that's where he, like, draws most of his influences from.
Well, you know, people like to talk about, you know, oh, he does the sickest fucking films you've ever seen. And I'm like, no. Well, he loves those grindhouse movies. Those are sick. I'm like, yeah, but if you think Tarantino's sick, have you ever seen The Sinful Dwarf?
No, I haven't seen that, but somebody recommended that to me on Facebook last week. So I put
it in my Netflix. The thing is you don't want to see it. I mean, you kind of do, but you kind of don't, especially if you can see the version that it's a Danish film, I believe, or Dutch, and there are versions with and without hardcore inserts.
Yeah. Well, damn. But you know, it's good that you brought this up, because I remember I was talking about, like, slasher films from the 80s, right? And how, like, Siskel and Ebert in particular, like, called them extremely violent and sexist and everything. And I thought to myself, a lot of those films were influenced by the giallos and the horror films from Italy in the 70s by Mario Bava, Argento. And those films are much more violent, right, than, you know, the 80s films were. You know, even if you look at, like, Friday the 13th.
Yeah, and then you have in the 80s and 90s, you have the guinea pig films from Korea and...
In Japan,
and
right?
Japan, and those are just like fountains of blood everywhere.
I've never actually seen one of those, but have heard of them.
I've only seen clips, and that's enough for me. And I'm not squeamish. It's just I want there to be a point to any action in a film. If it's just there merely for shock value, you know, I understand that for some people that's art, but for me it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's what I heard about those films, that they're really just ugliness for its own sake. And I really don't get into that stuff myself, so yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So what about you, Perry? What do you feel are some of his biggest influences? Or who?
I will go the other way with this and say that here's the thing about Tarantino that for me is the most annoying. Just in the public persona is that he, you know, there's a very thin line that separates Quentin Tarantino from comic book guy on The Simpsons. There is a level of I know this and you don't that he has leaned into his entire career. And I think it's purposeful. I mean, I think he is that, but at the same time, I think he purposefully plays that up. And so that's what everybody points to. When I saw Pulp Fiction, I thought, that's the first American film I've ever seen that actually absorbed, digested, and processed the French New Wave. It's not just the grindhouse stuff. He knows everything, and he knows how to take from everything. He'll point out all the grindhouse stuff because that's cool and makes him seem like he knows cool shit. But
well, you know, that reminds me of what I heard John Travolta say when he auditioned for Tarantino. He auditioned for Tarantino by going into a room with him that was filled with John Travolta memorabilia, made him play John Travolta ping pong, and spoke to him at length about his about old school TV and movies. And Travolta said, "I walked out of there and I was like, damn, I think I just got schooled."
Yeah, so, you know, I think this, you know, they are too great to mention. He is so multi-talented that to even just list film influences is a waste. I truly believe he owes as much to Elmore Leonard as he does to Sonny Chiba, if not way more. You know, it's just cooler to talk about Sonny Chiba. So I will go that route, and I will argue for the highbrow Tarantino.
Yep. So what about you, Sydney? What do you think? What are some of the influences you've noticed in his films?
You know, I was going to say there's a lot of obviously he loves the classics. Like everything can be, you know. Like, brought back to, like, some spaghetti westerns. He pulls from those. A lot of the violence is obviously, you can tell he loves the grindhouse genre as well. And I kind of want to say maybe, like, the old school Japanese films. Like, oh, God, what's his name?
Kurosawa.
Thank you. I knew you would know it when I blanked Kurosawa. But I like the ones that don't necessarily translate to the theme he's showing you. Like, I liked that basically Hateful Eight was just a retelling of The Thing. Like, that was really cool for me. When you took the sci-fi out of it, but it's the same story. Which, sometimes you can do stuff like that and it's really bad. But he managed to do it in a way where, honestly, I was like two-thirds of the way through the movie before I picked up on it, which is good.
Well, you know, I have to interrupt here to say I was one of those lucky fuckers that got to see it in the Roadshow edition in 70mm.
I hate you. But, okay, I did want to say something about the violence, though. Dear God, it's going to sound bad. I love violence. Like, horror is my jam. But Tarantino is not even in the same zip code as some violence, let me tell you. Like, if you just go to the torture porn genre of horror movies nowadays, like, Tarantino's almost funny about his violence. Like, come on, you chop off a head and there's blood spurting for, like, 2 minutes. But you watch Saw and, like, my skin crawls. Just not from the plot. The plot sucks. But, man, oh, man. Like, no. Some of the
newest
visuals I just can't deal
sucked.
With.
Spiral?
Oh, it was
I turned Spiral off after 5 minutes.
I cheered. Like, I was committed to the puzzle, and then I saw that, and I was like, what are you doing? You're like, spitting on Tobin Bell himself.
Yep.
I just watched my first Saw film not that long ago, Saw 2. I just wanted to see one of them, and I rented a full-screen DVD from the library by mistake, but I popped it in anyway, and even though it was full frame, it didn't really matter, because they didn't, everything was centered in the frame, right? They didn't even, like, shoot. It was shot in 1.85, right? But they didn't put frame any shots that well. They might as well have shot it in the 1.33:1.
Yeah, well, Darren Lynn Bozeman is not exactly a great cinematic talent when it comes to visuals. I know there's fans of Repo, the Genetic Opera, and it's not a terrible film, but it's got a lot of problems. So Aaron, finally to you, what do you see as his influences?
I'm going to stamp on Perry's. I mean, the man named his production company Band Apart, which is the actual title of Band of Outsiders by Godard. He told us from the beginning who he was, and then he tried to hide it with a lot of genre schlock. He is a highbrow artist who likes to go betting in his Cadillac instead of a four-wheel drive truck. This is a guy who I think owes a lot to art house, and just loves genre films as like that's his thing. But as a filmmaker, I think that his best moments are equally art house and genre. Obviously, lately Sergio Leone has been his master. Since Inglourious Basterds, that's been who he's been trying to figure out. And I think he's gotten there. I think he does Leo very well. But I can see where people prefer his earlier work because of that mimicry that he's been doing now for a while.
Yeah. So now comes to a set of questions that may take a little while to answer. And that is he better at writing or directing, and why? So, Gregory?
Even if one, you know, it was funny because I was talking about Kevin Smith the other day, and we're talking about how he generally does not know how to frame a shot at all. And I brought up the fact that I said, even if one doesn't like Tarantino's pictures, right, he knows how to, you know, he knows about camera movement, framing shots, you know, edit, you know, he owns his own movie theater and refuses to show anything digital. He knows the art of cinema. You know what I'm saying? So directorial wise, he's really, you know, he knows what he's doing. As opposed to, is it better than his writing? I don't know. I mean, they're just really kind of intertwined, you know. So it's hard to, like, you know, pick one or the other, because So I would say just probably equally. Maybe a little bit better on the visual side because, you know, well, actually, you know, I'll bring it up when you bring up Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I assume you'll bring up later, and, elaborate a little bit more on that.
So I will go now. What about you, Perry? What are your thoughts?
I'm gonna go exactly with that. I don't care to divorce the two for the simple reason that, you know, early on it was easy to say, oh, my God, what a great writer. That dialogue is unbelievable. I'm going just on Reservoir Dogs, and I remember sitting down and putting, yes, I'm this old, my Laserdisc of Reservoir Dogs in, and I had hit play, and I got a phone call. And so I just muted the movie. I didn't pause it. I don't know why. And I got on the phone, and as I'm talking on the phone, I'm watching the opening scene at the diner, and I don't know if you've ever done that. If you've ever imagined that scene, which seems to be nothing but dialogue, if you just watch how brilliantly it is framed and cut, I mean, what does he have to do to tell that story, right? He's got to make you believe that there is a bond between white and orange. He's got to do that, or else this does not work. Every single shot in that opening sequence, that 2-3-5 to one frame sequence, is, it's all of them solo unless you see white and orange together. They're always together. It's a two-shot for them. Everybody else only gets solos. He knows what he's doing visually at the most basic meat and potatoes level, and I realized, oh, he is that good. Oh, my word. He really does understand what he's doing. He understands when he's writing, and he understands when he's directing, and I'll go on top of that and say he understands how to direct like a writer. His movies do feel like novels. in the best sense of that compliment. Not that movies have to. Not that that makes them better, but they are. His are. Yes,
well, I think that it's interesting that Terrence, and you bring this up, you know, Tarantino is, you know, he's heralded as this great writer, which he is, and then he's also heralded as a great director, which he is. But I think sometimes people don't realize just how great a director he is, because they always think of, you know, the dialogue, the writing, and people seem to think that dialogue and writing are the same thing, and then they're not. It's kind of like for me with Billy Wilder, where people said, "Well, you know, he was a good enough director, but he was a great writer." And I'm like, "Did you not fucking watch the same movies I watched, like Double Indemnity and Lost Weekend, and you know, the list goes on and on, Sunset Boulevard. You know, you could name a dozen Wilder films at least." That show that he's every bit as good a director as he is a writer. And to be honest, you know, usually you get a guy or a gal who's or whoever that is they're usually better in one area than the other, and clearly better. The truly great writer directors, I think you can almost not decide for me which they're better at. And Tarantino is for me one of those. So what about you, Aaron?
So I literally, Perry, today told Adam that I finally figured out what my problem with Death Proof was, and it's that Tarantino writes novels. And when Death Proof was a movie, not a novel. But that aside, I think he's an amazing writer. I do think he's a better director than a writer, and I'll tell you why. Because I saw True Romance, and it was not as good as any of the movies he directed.
The script quality
was there, but the movie was not nearly as good. So Quentin Tarantino,
and that was Tony Scott, right?
Makes the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And so he's not
You can make the same argument from Dusk Till Dawn, which he also wrote.
Correct.
But did not direct.
Yep.
And Natural Born Killers.
Yep, that one too.
And Natural Born Killers.
Yeah, which you know, people, I don't get why people, do you still get the people that like point and say, "Ah, well, he only did a brief rewrite of it. He shouldn't do." I'm like, no. That's a Tarantino script if ever there was one.
Yeah. Which one, Natural Born Killers?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he wrote a script.
Oliver Stone
did
a rewrite, but
right.
It was,
yeah, he wrote. Tarantino wrote a script. Stone bought it and completely rewrote it, but it was still Tarantino's original work, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
That he disowned, but yes.
Yep. So what about you, Sydney?
You know, I was going to – I do kind of agree with you, first off, because I'm kind of 50-50. So I agree that you almost can't divorce the two, because there are definitely examples for me where the director – outstrips the writer. For example, James Cameron, the director, needs to fire James Cameron, the writer.
Either fire him or get somebody to help him co-write.
One of the two. Any of those would be preferable to making the same movie over and over again, just with different visuals. But then I think about the fact that if it's a Tarantino movie, my ass is in that seat, period, no matter what. But I actually skipped right over Natural Born Killers and the other one you mentioned that I now can't remember the name of.
True Romance or Dusk Till Dawn? Okay.
Yep. Never saw them because, Tarantino was in them. Or wrote them. Also, Tarantino is not a very good actor, in my opinion. I know some of you guys may hate me for that.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, he definitely needs to fire Tarantino, the actor.
Yeah.
Well, no, I think he was on an episode of Golden Girls.
Yeah, he was.
And I believe it was B. Arthur that told him, don't quit your day job.
He was a part of an Elvis impersonator troupe or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, he was.
He was apparently in ER, and I'm suddenly like, I wonder, like, was he a janitor or something? Because I do not remember that at all.
He directed an episode of the first season where Susan's sister Chloe gave birth.
Mother's Day.
Yeah.
Mother's
okay.
Day.
So I feel like my ultimate answer is I think he's a, even though they do go well together, I think he's a better director than he is a writer. Just a little bit though. Just a little bit. That's because I like him as a director over a writer separately.
Yeah.
Like if I have a choice of either or, I'm going to choose the director.
Yeah. Hey, Adam, can I bring up something?
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah, you know, there's another case of this. It's a little bit different. Is Otto Preminger. And Preminger produced and directed almost all his own film, all his films. He didn't write, but there has always been this theory in Hollywood and film circles that he was a better producer than a director, right? They said he was a great producer and a lousy director, right? And I think that's the furthest thing from the truth, because if you watch his films, visually the compositions are really are fantastic, the camera movement is great,
the
pacing
of the film. Man with
Golden Arm. Yeah, Man with Golden Arm, or even some of the later films. Like I remember watching Bunny Lake is Missing, filmed in the mid-60s not too long ago. And, you know, the camera's going in and out of rooms and everything, and the shots are all framed beautifully, and, like, the lighting schemes are so – you could tell they were well thought out. You know, yes, he was a great producer and a great director, you know. And I don't think either one overshadows, but they always say that about him, that he was a great producer, knew good material, but didn't know how to direct. He knew how to direct, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you could just like watch any like you know watch The Man with the Golden Arm. Just watch all, just the framing and the camera movements. It's like he knew what he was doing, you know. So
yeah.
I think this happens a lot in film, where they neglect like with Billy Wilder, like you said, great. They always say what a great writer. But yeah, if you look at the scenes and watch the visuals of his films, especially like the ones in the 60s where he shot them 2:35 widescreen, he really knows how to frame shots. You know,
look at that opening scene, and people always say, "Oh, well, that's all down to Trauner's set." But you know, what Trauner said when he picked up the Oscar is he said, "Thanks, Billy, for making my stuff look so good."
Mm-hmm.
So now we come to the next question, and I will go with you, Aaron. What is his greatest strength and flaw as a filmmaker?
It's the same thing. It is his encyclopedic knowledge of film history. He can call on it at any moment to make the perfect visual quote, and sometimes he falls back on it as a crutch. Death Proof, I think, again, not to beat a dead horse before we even get to the dead horse, is the perfect example of him just making an in-movie for all of his genre nerd buddies. Everything in that movie is a quote of another movie, and it's just tiresome after the first 5-10 minutes. But when he's dancing his camera around the underground bar in Inglourious Basterds, I'm spoiling all my best material for later. he really has a lot of Hitchcock going throughout Inglourious Basterds, the way he builds tension, where you know that a Tarantino-esque explosion of violence is coming, but the way he builds tension in that film is so much different than he did in any of his other films. It's that knowledge of cinematic history, I think, is is his best tool, but I think that his over-reliance on it at times gets him in trouble.
Yeah. So what about you, Perry?
I got two things that I can't let go of to answer this, and they're kind of related. And it's I think his biggest problem for me is his knowledge that he is Quentin Tarantino and that he has this thing he has to do. And it came through with me loud and clear, and we'll get into this more later, but it was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I think is one of his very best films. But when I saw it, it felt like, wow, you wrote this backwards. You thought of that last melee and figured out how to write to that. And then later in the interview, he said that. I'm like, yeah, that's your problem. And it's not a, I don't mean it's a problem in that it hurts his art. I want to be real clear about this when I'm talking about a problem. I just mean I fear he has boxed himself into what he thinks he has to do. And that's sad. I'm glad he's doing what he does. I don't mind.
Yeah, that's a good point, Perry. That you know, like, he has bought the media. So, the media has built up this, or not maybe not the media, but they've said, oh, this is Tarantino. This is what he does, and all of a sudden he's like, yeah, this is my box. I built this box. I can't. But you're right. He's not. He won't let himself out of it. You know?
Yeah, especially when he talked about, you know, we talked about in retrospect how he felt that Jackie Brown wasn't him. And I'm like, well, that's one of your other very best films. So if you aren't, if you were pushed off that for some reason other than you weren't happy with it, not having to do with the reaction to it, that's sad. But no, I don't think he has a problem as a writer or director. I think he's remarkably gifted.
Mm-hmm. So, Sydney?
So, actually, to expound on that, because I was going to say the exact same, something very similar and or exact to what you just said in terms of the worst part. Tarantino has a very, let's just say, Tarantino knows he's Tarantino, like you said. He also comes off in interviews like he knows his shit doesn't stink sometimes. Like, he knows he's awesome. And that comes off in his encyclopedic knowledge and stuff, which is fantastic. You know, there's a lot of bad traits to brilliant people, but, like, I don't know. That part always just rubs me the wrong way. Like, that's why I generally try to avoid reading interviews with Tarantino, because I just rather watch his stuff.
Yeah.
Because, and you know, like, the way I was going to describe it is, it really comes down to Tarantino's vanity. Like, he knows his shit doesn't stink. He has to be in every single one of his movies. But if he would just be less vain, he'd be good. But the thing I like the most about him, I love his attention to detail, though, which is, like, the other side of that coin. Like, I love, you know, the red apple cigarettes that show up. I love his little world building. And, you know, he loves, you know, the sets and the costumes and every little thing is like, he's so particular about it. And I love, like, watching the minutia that he does. And there are very few other directors that give it that kind of love and attention.
Yeah.
So go ahead, Tarantino, be an asshole if you're going to keep making great movies.
Yep. And so Aaron, Perry, and Sydney have answered this question. So now on to you, Gregory.
Okay. Just want to say something. That what Sydney was talking about him personally. I know a good friend of mine lives out in L.A., has met Tarantino on two occasions. One, that he went to a Pulp Fiction rap party all the way back in 1994, and he said that Tarantino was so nice to everybody, very laid back, very humble and everything. Ran into him again 10 years later and said he was a complete bastard to everybody, really full of himself. you know. So that just seems to be the way that the business rolls with some people, you know.
Yeah.
They start out humble, and then they get surrounded by sycophants or whatever, tell them everything they do is great, and then they just become like too, you know. I think the expression is head up their own ass, right? Now, he's not the only one that has been called
that.
Yeah,
cranial rectal inversions are a thing that seems to happen.
You know, you mentioned Terrence Malick before, and a lot of people have said that is true with him as well. I would disagree with that, but, you know, people have said that about him before online. But what I think his worst indulgence now is that his later films have been just going on for way too long. Hateful Eight and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I thought, needed cutting desperately. And I love long films. One of my favorite films is Satin Tango by Bellatar, which runs almost 7.5 hours. But
well,
I think it's,
well,
I think
hell,
every
Gregory,
shot.
Look at one of our favorite shows, which is also, according
yeah.
to its director, a film, and that's Haymon. When you take all three
right.
Haymons together plus Chronicle of a Vision, you've got nearly 60 hours.
Yeah, a 60-hour film, but it's a beautifully made film, you know. So the length is not the problem. Because people always say, like, oh, God, the film's so long. It's like, it doesn't matter. I like always what Roger Ebert said. A good film can never be too long, and a bad film can never be too short, right?
Yeah, and I think
yep.
that Ebert, maybe it was Tom Shales, but one of them, I think, was the one that said, you can tell a movie is bad when you become aware of your ass sitting in that seat.
Yeah, that's a good point, because he's right. And the Hateful Eight runs almost 3 hours, and the miniseries version, which I've not seen, runs even longer.
You need to see it. It's as close to the Roadshow as you're ever going to get.
Yeah. And then, like I said, I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which runs about 2 hours, 40 minutes. Felt that needed to be edited. Also felt Kill Bill, both volumes together. Well, actually, I'll talk about that when we get it, because it's a little bit more complicated than just editing it down, in my opinion about that. But then Pulp Fiction runs 2.5 hours, but that's okay. That's a good 2.5 hours. It's never a boring film. But just these last couple of films I just think are too long. Some people have said that his editor, Sally Metke, I think that's how you pronounce her name, she passed away several years ago. But, you know,
yeah,
she managed to...
Yeah, I think the last film she did was... Was it Django was the
exactly.
first film without her, or was it Django was the last
yeah,
film
I think
with her?
Django was the
I
first film without
Bastards.
Her. Bastards was her last.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that she managed to keep his indulgences, you know, centered. Somebody said that about Gloria, I think it was Gloria Katz, who was Lucas's editor wife, wasn't it, on Star Wars? And that she,
I
like,
it was Marshall,
you know,
Lucas.
Marshall
might
Lucas,
have been.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. But they said, like, you know, that kept Lucas, like, focused or whatever. And then when you watch the prequels, which were all, you know, overseen by him, writer, director, et cetera, they're very often very self-indulgent and also need a little bit of tightening, too. I used to have an expression that the longer the film, the better, but that's changed over the last, like, 10 years, you know. There's so many directors now. Like, Judd Apatow's like that, too. We're just like, would you please cut? Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm being indulgent now, so I'll be quiet.
So now I want to ask, who do we think is his most important collaborator? And I'll start with you, Aaron.
I've got two. First half of his career, second half of his career. His early pictures were all produced by Lawrence Bender. I think that went through Bastards. I think Bastards was the last movie they made together. And then every film since Kill Bill has been shot by Robert Richardson. And I think that is a fantastic collaboration. I am actually tempted to put Richardson as the one, with Bender being two, because the work they've produced together as director cinematographer has just been brilliant.
Yeah. Well, look at Hateful Eight alone. And people say, well, it's just right. one room. And I'm like, it's not about the vistas, folks. Cinematography isn't about the vistas.
Yeah.
It's not about vistas. Vistas are important, but you know, the vista has to like lead to something. Because I was out of Africa, was on TCM the other day, and it's not an awful film, but it feels like it's directed by like in a TV movie way. They'll show a vista, then tight shot, and it's pretty much the whole film. And I said, man, I wish David Lean had directed this, but he directed Pasadena the previous year, so he was probably a little bit tired from that. So he couldn't just jump in out of Africa. Sidney Pollack was a good filmmaker. But
I was suffering from a little bit of insomnia. I stuck in, put on Out of Africa, and about half hour later, I was sleeping like a baby.
That and the English Patient will put you to sleep. That's another one.
See, now, I actually like The English Patient, but I don't love it. But it may be because... I think it's, I'll be honest, I actually think it has more interesting visuals. I think it's a more interestingly visual film than Out of Africa. But I also think that Minghella may have been a better director than Sidney Pollack, and I know that's blasphemy to some.
Mm-hmm.
So what about you, Sidney?
So... Collaborators, I got two as well. I think Robert Rodriguez is...
Really? Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I do. Because, Grindhouse, that in and of itself, that was kind of... Didn't they have to, break the Directors Guild rules to make that in the first place as well?
Well, neither of them were in the Directors Guild, so...
Yeah. And, he's kind of influenced a lot of other films. Like, their friendship, I think, is very evident in a lot of his films. You can see it. You can see the crossover. And the other collaborator is Samuel L. Jackson. I feel like
now
it's the two of them work really, really well together, consistently and a lot.
I'm going to say this: Samuel L. Jackson stole Django Unchained.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't care that he was in it for marginally less than everyone else. Doesn't matter. He's the best part.
Judy Dench stole Shakespeare in Love, and she was only in it for 6 minutes.
Yeah. Sometimes the bit parts, so to speak, are the best parts of a lot of films.
Yep. So, Perry, what about you?
So it would be fun to do, he's one of the few directors where, you could actually do, an annoying clickbait headline of the 10 best Tarantino actors. And you could answer any one of those 10, and you could make the case. Sam Jackson, for me, I love what Kurt Russell has done for him in the last. I think he's been the great sort of creative spark of the last half. But for me, the number one answer, she's already been mentioned, it's Sally Menke. Sally Menke has still taught him how to do what he does better than he ever thought he could do it. And her death is... so horrifically sad for what Django and Hateful Eight could have been. Not to say that they're bad. I also feel like, wow, he had nobody he trusted to hear no from. And I think it's affected him. I'm not saying they're terrible by any means. I love them. But, Sally Menke is
I especially have a soft spot for Django, but I do wonder what it would have been like with her influence. I mean, think about this. This would have been, because let's say Tarantino sticks to his, I'm only doing 10 movies thing. That would have basically been like Scorsese losing... Schoonmaker around the time of Goodfellas.
Yes, almost. Yes, you're right.
or maybe at most around Lake Kundun.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so to you, Gregory.
I would have to agree about Sally. I think that was, you know what I mentioned before and just how she kept his films tight, even if, like in the case of, you know, Jackie Brown was a long film, too. I think that ran about 2.5 hours. But, you know, you never felt like you were just... Yeah, it is. You know, it's not like you're sitting on your ass, or you feel like when you all said, like you're feeling your ass grow, which is a bad thing when a film. You know, you're watching a film, and you become aware of your butt. Whatever critic said that, Tom, right? And you don't feel that way with Pulp Fiction. I saw that film twice in the theater. I never felt like I was like, come on, get on with it, you know. And it's one of the worst. It's like when you're at home and you're watching a film and you're just like, God, this thing is just dragging. You keep checking the time on it. It's just like, should I finish it? Should I throw something else on? You know, it's one of the worst things. It's like Frank Capra once said, there are no rules in filmmaking, only sins, and the cardinal sin is boredom. Right? And
he
I don't know when he said it, but he probably said it probably at his heyday, like in the 30s, so about 80 years ago, and it still holds true today. I mean, that goes for any art form, really. I mean, even if you're like listening
to
music.
You know, it's like mm-hmm. I said, I don't need a character to be someone to root for. I don't need to like the character, but you better mm-hmm. not fucking bore me. You know,
yeah.
The thing is look at the great example for me is Seinfeld. No,
mm-hmm.
I don't
yes.
exactly like those people, but I don't
right.
find them boring.
I know.
Hell,
they're really
Bad,
kind of
I don't
bastards.
Like Walter White, but I think he's a fascinating character.
Right. Or even like Absolutely Fabulous, right? Jennifer, you know, Adina and Patsy are
mm-hmm.
really nasty. They're nasty people, but you don't care because they're hilarious and the show is not boring. You know.
Yeah.
It's
so,
Kurosawa. Just make your film interesting. That's all you have to do. Sometimes we analyze these things too much. It's like, well, what are we supposed to do? Just don't be boring. That's all. That's your only job. Don't be boring. Okay? So let's go.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So now we're going to come to the last little bit of the thematic portion of the show, and I will start with you. Where do you think he fits in with modern directors, Aaron?
How modern?
Let's say since 1980, let's say or 75, the last 40 or 45 years.
I would say that he's probably towards the bottom of the top tier. I think that especially when you're looking at the people who came out in the early 90s, you've got Paul Thomas Anderson. Well, he was mid-90s. David Fincher, Guillermo del Toro, some of those guys. But I think he's right at or below that, just slightly below that level. I think that And culturally, I think that you can make an argument that he's beyond those guys for cultural importance. But to say that he is low top tier or very, very top of the second tier of people since, say, 1980.
Yeah. So, what about you, Sydney? Where do you place him?
He's pretty much in the top 10 for me because, for me, quality directors that I like, they have to answer like one thing. If I hear the name and I know something's coming out, will it get me to go? And also, will it get me to go, like, without seeing the preview? Like, if someone just told me there was a Tarantino movie in the theater tomorrow, and I never heard of it until right now, I would go. You don't need to tell me anything about it. My ass would be in that seat. And there's very few directors that I love so much that I can say that about. Like, that's right. Like, he's kind of, like, for me, in the same category as, like, a Scorsese movie. Like, if you said Scorsese came out with a movie tomorrow, I'd also be there.
Yeah, there are directors, and, you know, Scorsese and Tarantino are two of several right now that if I hear their name and somebody says, oh, they got a new movie, I'm like, okay, I'm there. Wait, don't you want – nope, I don't need to know what it's about.
Yeah, like, I would love to say – like, I would love to say that maybe Peter Jackson has the same for me, but not really. Like, you would have to tell me, like, oh, is it a fantasy movie? Oh, no? Well, maybe I'll skip it. Like, there needs to be no qualification for Tarantino for me.
Yeah.
As long as he probably wrote and directed, I'm there.
Yep. So, Gregory?
I think I'll just reiterate what Sydney said. It depends on what director, because there's certain directors, like when I hear they got a new film coming out, now that, you know, the pandemic is still going on, but we can go back to theaters again. Because I just saw, like, Roy Andersson, a Swedish filmmaker, I think you and I have talked about him before, he had a new film out this year, and that was the first time back in May that I actually went back to a theater. So when it's a certain director, you'll be like, okay, yes, I'll go see a film. Like Clint Eastwood's coming out with a new film this year called Cry Macho, which I'll probably go see in the theater, if, you know, provided everything is still cool. In terms of, like, you know, where is he at? You know, he's definitely, like, on the A-list, you know, of people who respect him and his reputation. You know, probably around, because a lot of those directors that came up in the 90s, you got P.T. Anderson, you got Robert Rodriguez, you got Kevin Smith. You know, and out of all those, Tarantino and Anderson are still, like, at the top in terms of, like, respect, or at least acknowledgement. Smith is pretty much...
I'd probably argue Fincher and Del Toro as well.
Yeah. Fincher's another good example. Yeah, people always forget he came up in the 90s too. You know, Alien 3, of course, and then 7, which came out in the mid-90s, which was his second film, and that's one that, you know, made his reputation. So yeah, he's definitely, like, if he releases a film, people will say, oh, here comes a new picture from this person. So, but, like, with the others, you know, some of them have just fallen to the wayside, like Smith, who just had a debacle with the new He-Man series on Netflix. And then who else did I say? Oh, Robert Rodriguez. When is the last thing he made? I don't even remember.
I can't remember.
It was like Lava Boy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, what was that, another one of those Spy Kids sequels?
Yeah.
No, it was a Shark Boy and Lava Girl sequel.
Oh, yeah, Shark Boy Lava. Okay.
Sorry, my mistake.
Oh, no, that's okay. Because, yeah, didn't his son, like, write the script for the original Shark Boy or something? And
I'm
he made
sure
it,
he did.
Probably. But, you know. So out of all of them, you know, Tarantino still gets, like, you know, people will still, like, go up to him and, like, say, yeah, I want to still work with him. He's still, like, considered A-list. Now, whether one likes his films or not, you can't deny that, like, he's still respected like that. It's like in the, when Pulp Fiction came out, even if you didn't like the film, you can't deny that it was a massive cultural phenomenon at the time, and everybody wanted to everybody did Tarantino knockoffs, right? I'm sure everybody who pitched a film in the 90s always said it's like Tarantino crossed with something else. You know what I'm saying? So.
Oh, absolutely. There was a great little show on Showtime, Beggars and Choosers, which Brandon Tartikoff created. And it was about a network. And the thing is they had more than once one of the characters, her job was to decide on shows. And she was complaining. She said, if I have to fucking listen to one more asshole come in and tell me it's like Tarantino meets whatever, I'm going to fucking stab them in the eye.
I always thought that 7, right, I just mentioned that film, that they went in and they pitched that, and they said it's like a cross between Tarantino and Silence of the Lambs, right, which was only out a few years before that. And that's probably why, because as we all know, it's a very dark film. So I'm thinking, like, how did this thing get greenlit by a Hollywood studio? You know, New Line Pictures, I think, put it out. Maybe that's what they did.
That's
it's
why,
like Tarantino.
Because New Line takes chances.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're big, independent, more or small, major, but yeah, they can take risks.
Yeah. So what about you, Perry?
Yeah, he's one of the very best. There's nobody. I mean, it's the we've mentioned all of the peers. That's the class, and it's unimpeachable for me. He's the rare director who actually takes the time to make the next thing. He's not. I love that he doesn't feel the pressure to do a movie a year or a movie every 2 years. He is ready when he's ready and has figured out how to play the game exactly how he wants to play it. And for me, even with Death Proof, I don't think he's made a bad movie, and I don't think he's capable of making a bad movie.
So, you know, that gets us – well, we probably have one question towards the end of the show, but now we're going to get into – before we jump into the movies, I do want to talk a little bit about his TV work. So has everyone here seen most of his TV work, like the stuff he did with CSI and ER?
No.
Yes.
No, no, I've not seen it.
Only ER.
Yeah, yeah. So here's the main question that I want to ask. Did his TV work scream Tarantino as much as his film work? For me, the answer is no, and it's because he didn't write them. He only directed them. I'm sure he had a pass at the script, but that's not the same thing as completely building it ground up. So I will now, Gregory, you said you did not see his stuff?
No, I've not seen the CSI. I didn't even know he directed a CSI episode. I knew he did the ER one.
He did one where somebody got buried alive, which seems to be a recurring thing for him.
And
so
then
what
he
about
did,
you,
I know
Perry?
He did. No, go ahead. Say yes, sir.
What about you, Perry? Did you say that you did see the ER and CSI stuff?
Yes, I have seen both of those. And, you know, Mother's Day is excellent. I mean, it's an episode of television you could just put on for somebody, and it's really good. I don't know that you'd know it was Tarantino. There are a couple of shots that you realize, yeah, they spent a little more money on this than they probably planned to, but that's about it. You couldn't tell. He knows the strictures of working in television. He obeyed them. That CSI episode just feels like a warm-up for that sequence in Kill Bill. It's, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's good. But it's, I, you know, if I'm going to rank them, I would encourage you to seek out Mother's Day. It's really good.
Yep, and ER, I think, is on Hulu now. I think that's its streaming home. So now, Aaron, you said you have not seen the Tarantino TV stuff?
Who?
Aaron, you said you've not seen Tarantino TV stuff? Okay, so Sydney, now I don't know if you've seen the CSI episode he did, but I know you saw the ER episode, so what are your thoughts real quick?
In terms of the TV versus his greater body of work?
Yeah.
It's definitely, like, I kind of agree with how it's already been said. You had to tell me it was Tarantino in order for me to know it was Tarantino, and I do think I agree with the statement that it's probably because he just directed, he didn't write, he didn't, you know, have a hand in the creative so much in that aspect, in like the creation of the plot and storyline and all that stuff. So it does show I think it shows he's a competent director. Like, he wasn't handed something and, he didn't write it, so it sucks.
Yeah. So, you know, I think this will be the place where I have to say, for the audience that may not know, Tarantino, of course, he did Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And within Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, one of the characters is an actor who was famous for a show called Bounty Law. Tarantino has written, I believe, 5 or 8 episodes of a proposed Bounty Law series, which he wants to either direct all or the majority of. And what I've been hearing is that Netflix may end up being the home of Bounty Law if it ever does get made. And yes, it would be
That's
in black
hearing,
and white, and it would mimic the look of an old 60s Western.
That See, man, that's what I was saying film. Earlier. And he loves the world-building stuff.
Yep. Yep. Now, I think it was Aaron. Were you starting to say something?
I said that's what I've heard, too, about Netflix and Bounty Law.
Yep. So, now, we're going to go through these as quickly as we possibly can. I don't want to rush through them, but, you know, we all know that Blog Talk likes to kick us off at around the two-hour mark once in a while, so we'll try to get through these. So what are our thoughts on Reservoir Dogs? Gregory?
Okay. Like I said earlier, first film of his I saw. And I remember reading, like I said earlier, my cousin Susan mentioned it. And then I read about it in Entertainment Weekly, and Ed also said it was extremely violent, which we've discussed that it has spurts of violence, but it's not like, you know, it's not like an extended, like, you know, like torture porn movie. And the first time I saw it, I really liked it. It's really a visceral film. You really remember, like, the shots, the camera work, of course, the guy, you know, Mattson cutting the cop's ear off. You, of course, remember that, you know, it just really, like, burns yourself into its brain. Now, I went back about a year or so later and watched it again, and I still liked it, but I didn't like it as much. And I think the reason is because it, like, offered everything up at once, right? Because I remember Kent Jones wrote an essay about Tarantino and John Ford, because Tarantino had said something about Ford that wasn't actually true. He had called him a racist or something like that.
Yeah.
So Kent Jones, who's a film critic and
he called
filmmaker,
him a racist conservative bastard.
Yeah, which, you know, anybody who has seen anything by Ford, who made over 200 motion pictures in his career, showed that he was an extraordinarily complicated man in both his films and in his life. And Jones put it very well in that. Now, this essay was written years ago, before, like, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out, before Hateful Eight came out, and it's how Tarantino's films are often visceral, and you get everything at once, right? And there's no nuance later. And I did feel that way about Reservoir Dogs, that you get everything the first time, and it's still a great film that first time, right? I'm not really I sound like I might be dissing it, but I'm really not. And I just remember going back the second or third time, it didn't have the same impact. But the initial impact was really, you know, honestly, quite extraordinary. And that really, like, was that first film. It's like, oh, my God, here's a brand new talent, you know? And it got him noticed, you know? It was a very audacious debut, to say the least, you know? And,
yeah.
You know, that you can still you can watch the film now. And I think you could still, if you haven't seen it before, you may still understand its impact, because it's still, you know, it has that visceralness. That's not going to go away. So, anyway, and like I said, I saw it on VHS first, pan and scan, couldn't help that. But then I have a laser disc of that film as well. And, you know, when I wanted to watch it, I'm like, oh, that's what it's supposed to look like, you know? That was a good thing about Laserdisc back then, even though they were prohibitively expensive. They at least were almost all letterboxed, and we didn't really get that with VHS, you know? Letterboxing was not a thing. It's a standard practice now on DVDs and Blu-rays and everything, but back in those days, they hardly ever did that with VHS tapes. Only special tapes like Lawrence of Arabia was letterboxed to Manhattan, was letterboxed, and those are the only two that I know of. So.
Yeah. So, Sydney, what about you?
Well, I actually, as that is one of those movies where I did not see it when it came out. I just saw it yesterday, actually, for the first time. So,
cool.
It's
mm-hmm.
his first movie, and I came to it last. And I kind of have the very opposite reaction that people have. It's not my favorite. It was really difficult for me to get into it and to watch it. I loved the opening. It was a strong opening, that opening scene. But that's kind of like Tarantino, that's the thing. He loves the strong opening.
Yeah.
And so that's to be expected. But as I'm watching it, it was very... It wasn't my thing. But also, it came off as so racist to me, and I know it was written that way, obviously, for a reason, but I couldn't, like, with Django, like, I understood why that movie was the way it was. I couldn't really pick up why Reservoir Dogs was the way it was, and it wasn't sitting right with me.
Yeah, you couldn't pick up on why it was such a big deal when it was made in the early 90s?
No, not why it was such a big deal, but, like, why the characters were so racist, blatantly racist.
Because
all
they were
the time.
Bad men.
Well, yes, but I kind of expected a little bit, I don't know, more to it than just bad men say bad things. So I kind of, like, there was more to Django than just that. So that's why it felt like racism on two very different ends of the spectrum to me.
Well, you know, I think you both just brought up an interesting point. Yeah, you know, it's because bad men say bad things, but I also think that at this point Tarantino hadn't matured as a writer enough, whereas by the time he gets to Django Unchained, he's able to add nuances that weren't there. Now, this is just me maybe playing devil's advocate here, because Reservoir Dogs is actually my second least favorite Tarantino. But I do think that, you know, he was treating it like a little pulp thriller and not worrying too much about adding a lot of depth to those characters. So, you know, I think that that's part of what you're dealing with, is characters that are more akin to sketches than full-bodied people, whereas by the time you get to Django Unchained, you're dealing with, you know, three-dimensional people.
Yeah. There are two movies that I don't like of his, and that is one of them. And it's not like, I mean, when I say I don't like, I'll watch him again. Don't get me wrong. Like, even his worst movies are still incredibly watchable. They're just not, like, movies, ooh, I want to watch this 20 times like I want to with, like, Django or Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah. Yeah. So what about you, Aaron?
I have complicated feelings about Reservoir Dogs. but I think I'm just going to quote Roger Ebert in his good but not glowing review, in which he says at the end of it, okay, Mr. Tarantino, you've proven you can make a movie like this. Now make a better one. Mm-hmm. And he did. His next film was a home run. And I think we saw a lot of the building blocks of what was coming in everything that follows Reservoir Dogs in Reservoir Dogs. But it was an immature film in a lot of ways, and it was a debut, and it was a very good debut. And debuts are my thing.
yeah.
I love watching early works by great filmmakers because a lot of the time you can see where they're going and they just can't quite get there. And I think that perfectly sums up Reservoir Dogs for me, is he knew where he was going. He just didn't know how to get there quite yet. And he was what? He was 24 when he made that movie. So, I mean,
jeez.
I think he was like 29. I think he was old. Was 29.
I think he was 29.
Yeah.
He was in his 20s.
Okay.
Yeah. He was older than Orson Welles was when he made Kane.
And
okay.
he had tried to make a film before that, which ended up he had to abandon. I can't remember the name. It was like
mm-hmm.
something my wedding or something like that. My friend's wedding or something along those lines. It appears occasionally on YouTube, but only about 50 minutes long. That's all he was able to shoot. So it's, I don't know. Have you ever seen that one, Adam?
No, but now I'm going to, I've heard of it, but I have not seen it. I'm definitely going to keep an eye out
birthday.
For it.
My best friend's birthday.
Thank you.
That's it. Yes. Mm-hmm. No,
and
that does
I've
show
seen,
up on YouTube.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've watched a little bit of it. It just seems like a 90s indie kind of thing, you know, where a bunch of people are kind of just talking. It's not the worst thing I've ever, like, seen. It's not like, you know, you talk about debuts, Fear and Desire by Kubrick, which has to be one of the worst debuts, I think, of any major director. You know, some people defend the film, but I'm not one of those.
I defend it only in that I believe that it should be preserved as an example of even great directors can make a really bad fucking movie.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, we all know Kubrick tried to suppress it, and I don't agree with that. I'm glad that it's available. It doesn't diminish
and, you know,
his other...
It does have some interesting and important actors in it. I mean, I think, wasn't Paul Mazursky in the cast?
Yeah, he was.
It's significant for a lot of reasons and should be preserved. But, yeah, so what about you, Perry?
Yes, it's a film I can't divorce from when I saw it. I saw it at exactly the right time. And I will say this. Yeah, it's not his best film. I haven't bothered. I can't rank them. I have a hierarchy. It's not in the top tier. But I will say this, and why I still go back to it every few years. If I didn't, early on when we talked about his themes, if I were to pick another one, it would be he is really comfortable playing with the idea of performance and the old Vonnegut quote of, you know, you are what you pretend to be, so be careful what you pretend to be. And he knew that. He knew that was his obsession straight up, because that's what Reservoir Dogs is about. And that he lays that so clear, and that he showed his remarkable skill with actors and his gift for dialogue and for pacing, both pacing dialogue and pacing scenes. It's a great debut. And I think it's still a really, really good movie. Yes.
The fact that I ranked it as my second least favorite doesn't mean I think it's a bad movie.
Right. No. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. I think it's really good, and it is worth going back to, not just as a starting point for Tarantino. I think it's good on its own terms. Not great, but good.
Yeah. So, excuse me. So, Sydney, Pulp Fiction.
It was in my top three for a while. But, I don't know. I couldn't do it at the end of the day. It's right on the cusp. Because it's right there with Kill Bill for me. Because I saw them at the same time. So it's really hard for me to separate Volume 1 and Pulp Fiction from each other. But, oh, God, do I love that movie, though. It's iconic, and I don't know. Again, that opening scene. You've got this thing with opening scenes, man. That's just so quotable. Cheeseburgers. Like, how can he possibly make a, what was it, 10 minutes about Canadian cheeseburgers. It's the most compelling.
Without either of his principals.
Yeah.
Speaking about that scene, Maurice LaMarche and Rob Paulsen, the voices of Pinky and the Brain from TV's Pinky and the Brain, did a reading as Pinky and the Brain of the Royale with Cheese discussion. If you guys haven't seen that, I will send you guys the link in the group chat after.
Please.
It is absolutely fucking brilliant, particularly the part where Maurice LaMarche as the Brain swears and says, well, now you've heard the shit, you can't unhear it. In perfect
I feel
brain.
Like you can just, that's like the thesis of like Tarantino's movies sometimes. You've heard the shit, now you can't unhear it.
Yes, exactly.
And let's get this straight. Wells would have loved Tarantino and would have been in a Tarantino film in a heartbeat, okay?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Had Orson lived another 10 years, you goddamn know he'd have begged, borrowed, and stolen to be in Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown.
He would have been a great Marcellus Wallace.
Oh no.
You know, actually, I think you are correct. I think he would have been.
I think he is too.
Although the Orson Welles with the gimp. That's a doubly horrifying image. Let's move on. Aaron, your thoughts on Pulp Fiction?
Pulp Fiction is his monolith. You hate to put it quite that bluntly. It's fascinating and exciting and sad a little bit that his best film was his second film, but it was so good that it doesn't matter. It's a perfectly told story. The casting is brilliant. Bruce Willis gives probably his best performance, as does John Travolta. There can be an argument for Uma Thurman and Samuel L. Jackson as well. And these are major talents giving the best performances of their careers. There is not a single thing I can think of off the top of my head that I dislike about Pulp Fiction. It's really the film that cemented my appreciation and, at times, full-out devotion to Quentin Tarantino, filmmaker.
Yeah. So, Gregory?
Saw it when it came out. Saw it twice in the theater. Did like it. Liked it quite a bit. Not, like we discussed earlier, well shot, well edited. A little bit leisurely paced, but that was okay, because it kind of worked. It wasn't boring. And to say that it was I'm not sure if it did, like, phenomenal box office at the time, but it was as we all know, this is
$214 million.
Yeah, so probably that would be today's. Today, that would be probably twice as much by with inflation. So, yeah, pretty good haul. But its cultural impact, right, was just enormous. Even today, it still is. You know, people still talk about that, and everybody was like, I'm the next Tarantino. And then, like we discussed earlier, every pitch head, it's the Tarantino, you know, mixed with this or whatever. But, you know, after like seeing it like a couple of times, it's still kind of fun to watch. But sometimes, you know, maybe a slightly contrarian viewpoint here. Sometimes if you think about it too much, it doesn't make any sense. Because like when Bruce Willis and Marcellus Wallace get into the car accident and the chopper gets smashed and then they start fighting each other in the streets, no cops ever show up, right? And I think the cops would show up in that scene.
Especially in that area of L.A.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and like near the end when they're in the coffee shop and, you know, everybody's got the guns aimed and that scene goes on for about like 15, 20 minutes. You know, it's a coffee shop. Cops hang out in places like that. No cops show up. Nobody comes in. Nobody goes out. They didn't close the doors. You know, they just decided, hey, let's just rob the place. Hey, let's improvise, you know. I think that would happen. And that the fact that, like, Willis, you know, threw the fight so easily, he made all these bets with his brother. I think his brother was the bookie, right, when they were talking in the phone booth, right?
Yeah.
And I think that would have, like, set alarms off with, like, the local bookies and everything. Like, why is he doing all this? You know, so they would have maybe taken him out beforehand. He also mentioned that the other boxer didn't even lace his gloves up, which would not happen. If you're going to throw a fight, you're going to, you know, you have to go like 4 or 5 rounds. Then your ass goes down. You lace up your gloves. You make it look professional, right? So that to me, I mean, like I said, I'm being maybe slight contrarian here, but there were a lot of like plot holes in that picture, right? Still entertaining, still fun to watch, but, you know, just as long as one doesn't think about it too much. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yep. So, finally to you, Perry.
Boy, how to say it all and keep it brief. So, I will go back to what I said way earlier tonight. It's the only film I've seen, the only American film that absorbed Godard and spat it back out whole and knew how to do something with it. It's utterly brilliant. It still is, and it is a monolith. It is, and I don't know that it's even his best film anymore. It's sort of not even his anymore. It is one of those totemic movies. If for no other reason than, and I don't think this gets talked about a lot, yeah, it crossed 100 million. Like I said, I think you say it reached 200 million. I remember when it crossed 100 million. It was a big deal. And that film really, truthfully, ended the American independent movement as I understood it to that point. Like from 1980 to there, it's over. Because then Miramax figured out how they could chase $100 million on a smaller budget. And then it was within a year they were, you know, they sold to Disney. And that was it. And there was another great period. I'm not saying it devolved, but it is such an easily dividing point for a next movement in what American movies
were. Ladies and gentlemen, listen to what Perry just said. They sold to Disney. That means Pulp Fiction is a Disney movie.
Yep. Expected on Disney Plus next month.
Yep, right next to Avengers Endgame and Kevin Feige's Ego Trip Number 3.
Can I just mention one thing? Sydney had mentioned that Tarantino should not act anymore, right? Which I wholeheartedly agreed with. And the scene where he's in Pulp Fiction exemplifies that, right? When you are looking at, like, the four actors, you've got Keitel in there, you've got Travolta, you've got Jackson, three wonderfully seasoned actors, just oozing presence in that scene. Even if they didn't say anything, you see the presence. And then here's Tarantino. He's got little to no presence on screen. I mean, he's dwarfed, not, like, literally, but his presence is dwarfed by those three great actors, you know?
Jimmy's not supposed to have presence.
Yeah.
I'm fine. I am fine with Tarantino in that part. I'm not saying I want to see him in anything else, but I'm fine with him there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, can we just say that, you know, one of the things that, you know, that whole Jimmy sequence, you know, of course, where it's like, damn, I shot Marvin in the face. Well, of course, Marvin is played by an actor that's best known for doing voice work. He was the voice of Hermes Conrad on Futurama, and he voiced Jack in Samurai Jack. So there's a little trivia for people.
So you said Samurai Jack and
Sequence.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I did not know that, Adam.
Yeah, but, you know, but that's a sequence that somebody asked me a question a long time ago, you know, show me one scene from Pulp Fiction that's why I should watch this movie. And I actually chose that sequence, that sequence where Keitel comes in and he's talking to Jimmy. And,
the body situation.
You know, they're out in the garage saying, you know what, I'm Superfly TNT, I'm Guns of the Navarone, I'm napalming this movie. You know what, fuck you, you're going to be on brain duty. Just clean up this repugnant shit. That is just, you know, and another thing, you know, when Sam Jackson lost the Oscar, he clearly mouthed fuck. And that is one of the things that, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm about 14 by the time the Oscars came on that year, because it was 95 when the 94 Oscars came on, so I'd had my birthday already. And I was already following, you know, award shows a little bit. But it was seeing Sam Jackson say fuck that made me go, oh, damn, anything can happen here. And so I really got into award shows for a long time after that, mainly on the basis of Sam Jackson mouthing fuck when he lost.
Well, you know, to date, Mr. Jackson has not won an award, correct?
No, and I don't even know if has he been nominated since?
I don't think he might. I'd have to check, but, you know, he's done such amazing work, you know, and yet, yeah, he might end up like the pantheon of, like, Kubrick and Hitchcock, you know, like all these great directors or great entertainer people work in the film industry who never got an Academy Award, like Peter O'Toole. I mean, he got a Lifetime Academy Award, but he never won Best Actor, you know. I mean, Jackson will probably get that if he doesn't get nominated for something, but, you know. Like, still, but, you know, it just boggles the mind sometimes. And sometimes it's not intentional, though. Because sometimes it's like when, like in 73, when Pacino was nominated for Serpico. I mean, Pacino eventually got his Academy Award, but, you know, Jack Lemmon won that year for Save the Tiger, right? And you're like, how can Pacino not get for Serpico? But Lemmon had been around for long. That was his only Oscar. So it was sort of like a Lifetime Achievement Award, you know? Like when Paul Newman got one for Color of Money, which was a reprise of the role he played in The Hustler in 1963, I think. You know?
Yeah, and I have to say that I actually think Color of Money is okay, and I thought that Newman was actually very good. Actually, hell, I think that Tom Cruise isn't bad in that movie.
The performances are good in that film, but it has kind of like a latent 80s vibe to it, and I don't think it's as good as the original. The original I really like.
I think has, believe it or not, I think because of the black and white cinematography, it might be more visually interesting, which is sad when you're speaking of a Scorsese film, but there you are.
Plus,
so,
Jackie Gleason is so good in that film, too.
Yes, yes. So, Aaron, Jackie Brown. Aaron?
Is Aaron there?
Did Aaron
I'm sorry,
get...
I'm on mute. On mute. I don't know why. First, I want to interject something real quick. Samuel L. Jackson has already been announced as an honorary Lifetime Achievement Award at the Oscars for next year.
Oh, wow.
Well, they must have heard us talk. That was quick.
Jackie Brown is a heck of a movie. At the same time, I actually agree with Quentin Tarantino that it is not a Quentin Tarantino movie, because it, as an adaptation, I think is equal parts Tarantino and I'm
Elmore
so
Leonard.
Sorry, I'm blanking on his name all of a sudden. Thank
Elmore
you.
Elmore Leonard.
Thank you. But once again, you look at the performances. Robert De Niro is so good in that movie in a role that is just so thankless. And it's one of my favorite De Niro roles, especially of like the second half of his career. All he does is sit around with an unbuttoned shirt all day. He smokes crack with Bridget Fonda. Robert Forster is the standout in the cast, and he was the one who got the Oscar nomination, which he lost to Burt Reynolds, I believe, which is fair.
No. That was 97, so...
Robin Williams.
Yeah, Reynolds never got anything for Yeah, Boogie Nights. Was he? Yeah, he never. He didn't win that year. I don't think. I think Reynolds is another one. He never got an Academy Award.
No.
But then,
that was a hell of a year for supporting actors.
I mean, he
actors.
Did some really good dramatic, but then he did some really bad films in the '80s, as we well know. So.
Yeah.
Like Stroker Ace, and well, never mind. Forget I brought that film up.
It's just a tight little caper. Pam Grier is amazing as Jackie Brown, who Tarantino actually re-swapped the character and changed the last name of the title character of the book specifically for Pam Grier because he so badly wanted to work with her. She really badly wanted to work on Pulp Fiction, and he said, I'm sorry, I don't have a role for you in this one. And then he wrote Jackie Brown for her and then still made her audition, which to me is hilarious. And then The Room, as it was with Travolta, was just filled with Pam Grier memorabilia. So I think that, I think this is great.
Mm-hmm. Perry?
It is in the pantheon for me, for Tarantino. I think it's, I have four films that are up there. Pulp is one. This is another one. I'll say a couple things. I am not being hyperbolic when I tell you that this is an interracial middle-aged love story, making it the most subversive film he ever made. I'm not
very true
about this. This is something. This is as close as he got to Howard Hawks. Okay? I regret how much he doesn't appreciate how good that film is or doesn't think it's how he was supposed to go, because it's like this beautiful path that he never decided to continue, and I really wish he had, because I would have loved to have seen something else in that same vein, something so comfortable with just people talking. It's the, you know, it is one of the few films where the giant act of violence at the end isn't that big a deal. I mean, it is an apply, but it's not what it's leading to. It really has been the journey to get there. And the last thing I want to say about it is, yes, I haven't talked about the violence in Tarantino films tonight. I've agreed with everything everybody said. It's way overblown. And at the same time, man, Robert De Niro shooting Bridget Fonda is the single most shocking, horrific act of violence in any Tarantino film. It stuns me. It stunned me at the time, and it still hits me every time. It's fantastic.
Totally agree.
And it's not bloody at all.
Part of it is it's just so matter of fact.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Gregory, what about you?
Yeah, saw it a long time ago, and only saw it once, but I did like it very much. It had like layers of depth to it, and you know it was obviously based on Elmore Leonard's novel, so I think that could be one of the reasons as to why Tarantino dislikes. It sounds almost like he's disowned the film. Now he hasn't done that, has he?
No, at all. But it is like this weird thing where he talks about how it just wasn't. He talks about it like he felt like he got back from his audience that this is not what they wanted.
Okay.
And I'm like,
because you know it is a well-made film. Greer is wonderful, you know, and it's a shame she didn't go on to become like the big star, which she completely deserved. You know, she just has just wonderful screen presence. She's a beautiful, beautiful, talented lady. Bridget Fonda.
He may
is
also
great.
Not like it because it's actually next to Death Proof, and which you can't really count Death Proof because it's part of Grindhouse, and you can't really count Reservoir Dogs because it opened on so few screens. But it is his least financially successful film.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was his most subversive.
Yep.
So, but yeah, I thought it was a good picture. Like I said, I haven't seen it. I saw it when it came out. I haven't seen it in a long time. So probably a revisit is in order.
Oh,
but,
absolutely! It's a wonderful film.
But,
I hadn't seen it in forever, and
but you know
I finally watched it a couple months back in prep for this, and it's great.
The thing was, I remember when Kubrick made Barry Lyndon, that was a box office disappointment, right? And now, like, that film is revered by people. And Kubrick was like, I remember reading an interview with one of his assistants, and he was like, why didn't it do? We did a really good job on it. He's kind of disappointed it didn't do better. And the thing I would say, I said this on Facebook before, in the 70s, period pieces didn't do particularly well. Barry Lyndon was released in the 70s, A Bridge Too Far, right, which was made a couple years later. That was a very well-mounted picture. That didn't do well at the box office. And even like in Italy, Ludwig by Visconti, right, was a wonderful film. Actually, my favorite Visconti picture. And that didn't do well at the box office. So maybe it was just maybe timing, perhaps. But, I don't see why he's like so, I don't know. He seems to be hostile towards that, towards Jackie Brown. And I'm not, his audience may not have liked it. But, you know, sometimes, you know, you have to follow your gut. And if your gut says, I'll get it. You know, maybe you could. It's like with Dylan when he went electric. He pissed off some of his folky audience, but he picked up a lot of new fans. Right? They were like, "Hey, I like this shit now." Right? So, you know, and then some of the folky fans eventually came along. You know, because they, you know.
So, what about you, Sydney?
Okay, so I don't hate it. But I don't love it either. Because this is one of those two movies that I did not see until this morning, actually. And just to let you know, I had to restart it twice, and I fell asleep three times. And I feel like Reservoir Dogs and Jackie Brown have the exact same problem, and that I think he was really trying to find his footing with the pacing, because that's the reason I kept falling asleep. It wasn't because it was an uninteresting premise or bad acting or any of that. It was just so slow that the pauses were so long that I would just fall asleep at 8 o'clock in the morning watching this movie three times. The last movie that did that to me was seeing the IMAX version of the third Matrix. I just slept through that entire movie.
Wow.
In the IMAX. My sleep was vibrating, and
I'm
still
not
out.
Saying, wow, because
you said the IMAX
movie. I hate the movie. It's just I remember it being a big, loud, unholy fucking mess, and I'm shocked anyone could get sleep during that.
Yeah. And Adam knows me well enough to know that it takes a lot for me to, one, stop a movie that I've started, or to fall asleep during a movie.
Sorry, Nora. Cindy, what was the name of the film in IMAX again?
The third Matrix movie.
Oh, the third Matrix
Revolution.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, whatever that was called.
I didn't see it, but a friend of mine who loved the first film and was looking so forward to the two films said the third one was a piece of shit. He just hated it.
Well, yeah.
I loved the first one so much. And by
the
like...
The second one has
more. The second one was all right. Yeah, the second one was all right.
The first one was fun.
I know the ending of it because I think I woke up for the ending, so I know how it ends. But I don't remember any. I don't know how we got there. That's the thing. Like, I woke up, saw it, and I'm like, okay, that sounds good. And then I left, and I've never felt compelled to watch the whole thing. But what's funny is the Animatrix was very good, and that came after. So I'm like, why did you waste all your effort on that thing?
Yeah.
But
so,
I felt the same problem with Jackie Brown. I couldn't stay awake, and I had just woken up. Like, there were so many things stacked against it. I was like, why am I not paying attention to this? So technically, I still haven't finished it. Because I tried twice, fell asleep a third time, and went, well, obviously, I'm not supposed to watch this.
Yep. Now this is where we usually take a little time to two announcements. Carl does have an ISF podcast coming up on Tuesday. I think there may be a show either Saturday or Sunday. It was up in the air, so please check your schedule. And this show will be back next week with an episode on none other than The West Wing. And we were going to do that episode last week. Things came up, so we're rescheduling it. And then Downton Abbey may get pushed to the following week. So please tune in next week for an episode on The West Wing. We've had this... this is actually one of the first episodes I ever scheduled, and it's taken 2 years for it to finally come together. Now, having said that, watch technical problems emerge, and that brings us to the next thing that I need to announce, which is that Blog Talk has been great in some ways, and a little bit of a pain in others, but that it is time to announce the Deviant Legion shows, and that includes my own Cathode Ray Mission, will slowly be moving to a different platform, to Zencastr, and this will begin next month. We will all be remaining on Blog Talk for the foreseeable immediate future, and we will be continuing our shows over on Zencastr, but we do want to let everyone know that this is a change that is happening, and to prepare. Please seek us out. We'll definitely let you guys know. As I always say, we couldn't do this without our listeners, so we definitely don't want to lose you guys. We want to give you a heads up that this is something that's happening. It'll be easy to listen, and yet not as difficult for us to record, because let me tell you, there are some real technical problems some weeks, and this should make for a series of much smoother broadcasts. So having said that, what I want to do is I want to get back to good old Quentin, and we're going to treat this one, Kill Bill, the way that Tarantino treats it. It's a single film, even though it's in two volumes. We can debate that, but we're not going to say, well, what do we think of the first one? What do we think of the second one? We're not going to do that. So I will begin with you, Aaron. What do you think of the whole bloody mess?
Well, for starters, I don't think it's the whole bloody mess. I do think there needs to be a coda to Kill Bill, in which the daughter of Vivica A. Fox's daughter comes back for Beatrix sometime later. And this is where I'm going, the overarching theme of this film is the corruption of violence. We see it with Oren's origin. We see it with the visual motifs of blood staining white surfaces. Violence is a corrupting force in all of these people's lives. And so to truly complete this story, we have to put a capstone on it. And the capstone is the daughter of Copperhead coming back for Black Mamba.
So other than that, what do you have specifically to say about Kill Bill? Anything real quick?
It's a fascinating film. I would say that it's the very top of his second tier of films. I think that there are times when it gets a little messy, but it's truly a novel on film in that he gives us information as we need the pertinent information. He's not telling us how the story went from A to Z. He is telling us the story and then giving us the background as we need it, which is how a novel is constructed. You have flashback sequences in novels that give you the background. You don't have all of the background leading up to that moment. You get it as you need it. And I think that's a really interesting experiment that he did in Kill Bill, more so than his other films. And I think it works. I think he gets lost in a tangent or two. But for the most part, I think that it's a really wonderfully constructed film.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's got a lot of fascinating flourishes, like the anime sequence, the fact that, although we all know that it was Hilda Hedevoid, a hard rating from the ratings board, you know, having a sequence in black and white. But, you know, you get this real fast, action-filled volume one, and then the second half of it is much more leisurely. It's basically three or four big sections. And it's like a whole bunch of little half-hour, 40-minute movies put together. For some people, it doesn't work, but for me, you know, it really does. I probably do think that the first half is more exciting, but I don't think it works as a whole without that more lyrical, laconic, even second half. So what about you, Perry?
We're real close on this. You know, it's probably the Tarantino film I have revisited the least, if only because, yeah, it was – I have a real sort of – you know, the concept of breaking up into Volume 1 and Volume 2 exists only for economic reasons, meaning the American public won't pay $8 for a four-hour movie. They should, but they won't. So I'm left with this, like, the volume one ended, and I remember thinking, okay, I'll find out in 6 months if this is a good movie. That was a sure fun exercise in styles, plural, but I didn't know. And then I love part two. What I love in part two, I don't feel like I have to sit through all of part one again in order to get out of it what I love to get out of part two. I love the last long sequence when she's finally with Bill again and the Superman monologue and all of that. I love that he structured, you know, this incredible ballet of violence throughout the whole thing to end it with, again, this from a filming violence standpoint, the most anticlimactic thing possible, which is fantastic. That's really funny, and it's a very wonderful self-knowing wink at himself, which Quentin doesn't do a lot, and that I appreciate that about it. I like the film a lot, but it is not in my Tarantino pantheon.
No, it's not in my top three, but it's probably like number four for me. I mean, it's a lot of fun. Come on. Gregory.
Yeah. Now, when I watched the film, you know, many years ago, I watched it all the way through. I watched it as a continuum, and I probably shouldn't have done that. Even though it was, as we all know, it was originally supposed to be a film.
Can I interrupt you 1 second? We just got a warning from Blog Talk. Ladies and gentlemen, we may get cut off. So if we do, we apologize. If not, the conversation will continue and be available once the episode uploads. So please continue, Gregory.
Okay. So I watched both volumes in one sitting. And maybe in retrospect, I don't think I maybe should have done that, even though it was supposed to be one continuous movie. I think originally the running time was supposed to be around 3 hours, and then just Tarantino just kept adding stuff and just made it longer and longer and longer. And then Harvey Weinstein, who was Miramax, decided, to indulge Tarantino and say, okay, we'll just release it as two films, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I remember watching part one. I liked volume one. Better in volume two. I felt that it should have been cut down to about a 2.5 hour, maybe a 2 hour and 40 minute picture, which you have volume one as the main focus, and that you take stuff from volume two and put it as flashbacks. I think that would have worked out better, because often now, keep in mind, I have not seen the film in a while, but I just remember thinking like volume two felt almost like outtakes, right? And it just—I don't know—it just didn't flow. It could have been shorter. I think it could have been like a nice 2 hour, 45 minute film. And I just think that 4 hours of it was just a little bit overboard. Even though we talked earlier about Sally Metke and how she usually kept him focused, and I know she edited this. I'm pretty sure she edited this picture as well. But yeah. I did feel at the time that it was indulgent. And that it should have been cut down to a smaller running time. Having said that, Volume 1, I think, is better. The animated sequence in Volume 1 is a beautiful sequence, a film in itself. And I really like. I remember watching it. I felt like, I felt there was a poignancy there. And it was directed by a famous who directed that scene? It was a famous animator in Japan, right?
Yeah, I can't remember. I want to say it's the people from Madhouse, but I might be mistaken. I think it's the same people that did Ninja Scroll.
Mm-hmm.
Or Ghost in the Shell.
It was. No, it was Ninja Scroll.
Okay, yeah. So, that brings us to you, Sydney. What are your thoughts on this one?
It is in my top three. It is so good. Actually, no, I'm sorry. It almost was my top three. I wanted it to be my top three so badly, but Inglourious Basterds beat it out. But I love it so much. And, like, to be honest, I do love the first one better than the second. For, actually, the reasons you described, it felt like they weren't quite even the same, even though it's supposed to be the same movie. It felt different even in pacing and the way it's presented. But if I'm being really, really honest, the part that I will watch, just go watch that part. It's like the solid 15, 20 minutes that I'll just watch over and over and over again. And it's all the Orenishi stuff. Like, from her origin story to her death. I love that entire bit. And I especially love when she takes Tanaka's head. That monologue is just brilliant. I love Lucy Liu. And that entire thing, it makes you gasp. And then it makes you go, oh, she's a badass, and now I don't want her to die. And you kind of feel that way about all of them. Like, you don't really know whose side you're on in the entire first movie. You're like, oh, I want to be on the bride's side. But, oh, these are all badass women, too. And we don't really know why they killed her, so maybe they have a point.
Well, remember at the end of the movie, she's crying. And she's not crying just tears of joy because she's with her daughter,
Yeah. But
she's lived her whole life for violence, and she's lived however long since she got out of the coma for vengeance, and now what does she have to live for?
And also, she also just killed her friends as well, so to speak. Like, these are the closest things she had to friends.
Yeah.
That's always what I assumed. Like, these are the epitome of complicated relationships.
Bill more than the rest of them.
But these are the epitome of complicated relationships.
But so now we come to the film that I wish Tarantino had never fucking done this shit. you know.
Tell us how you really feel about it.
Death Proof. You know, yeah, look, I love Kurt Russell. He's great. He's awesome. Even here, he's pretty good. Big Trouble in Little China and Escape from New York, fantastic. He was great as Herb Brooks in Miracle, so many other movies. But this is just maybe the most self-indulgent piece of shit Tarantino ever cooked up. And he ought to be ashamed of it, but he's not. So there you go. The fact that he would rather talk about this movie than Jackie Brown is telling. So I will start with you, Perry. What do you think of Death Proof?
Okay. If I give you that it is the least Tarantino, I will also argue it's still good. Granted, you have to be a Tarantino connoisseur. I'm not going to sit you down in front of this if you've never seen the man's work. But here's why I really like it. First of all, it's so much better than Planet Terror. And after sitting through Planet Terror in the theater, I was so happy to watch Death Proof. So just my memory of experiencing it the first time is so much better than what came before.
I like the Machete trailer better than this shit.
I don't disagree, but that's hyper. I also think the Thanksgiving trailer is the only good thing Eli Roth's ever done. That's a matter of taste. I'm not this is a personal preference issue. I want to be clear on this. That said, I really like it because it is, I think, the one moment where Tarantino is fessing up to what he fears he would become. I think he's afraid that he's Stuntman Mike. If he let his worst instinct go and he calcified into truly believing all of his hype. And I think it's a really interesting film for that very reason. Yes, it's slow. Yes, it is dialogue heavy, arguably pointlessly dialogue heavy. But as a sort of nascent, think of it as sort of a fetal version of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I kind of like it, and I still do.
Well, you know, there's one in every crowd. So, so Gregory, you?
Yeah. No, I think we talked about this on Facebook last night. I have not actually seen Death Proof all the way through, just clips. But I would like to ask everybody: did you see it? Did you see it with? In the original, like, Grindhouse presentation with Planet Terror, or did you see it? You did, okay. Now, okay. The reason I bring this up is I do not understand this sort of not you all personally. You're all Tarantino fans. That's why you saw the picture. But this obsession that some people have with the Grindhouse phenomenon, for lack of a better term. As we know, the term Grindhouse was a nickname or a name used for theaters that usually were in Times Square, who were very run down, very sleazy places. And when you were projecting the prints, they usually were discolored, and for some reason, a lot of people thought, like, oh, that must have been really so cool. And then they would show films like The New York Ripper by Lucio Fulci and that, of those Italian westerns and those Italian horror films that Tarantino talks about, right? And so they were trying to emulate that experience. But the thing is about that experience, I don't think it's worth emulating. Because why would you want to watch a film in a bad print? A lot of times these places were so run down, they didn't even bother changing the projectors, right? So the film would go through the projectors and would just make it worse, right? Because the gates weren't clean, the lights weren't clean, you know, so it would mess them up. So I never understood, like, why the fascination that everybody had with that, that Tarantino has with that, or even Rodriguez,
too.
No,
it baffles me. I can only speculate that... there's a whole lot of nostalgia, stupid, and maybe even drugs involved.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that, Adam. And the thing is, too, about, like, New York Ripper, I mentioned, Fulci's film. I saw it in a Blu-ray presentation. Somebody posted it in full on YouTube, and I watched this. I watched the Blu-ray, like, transfer on it, right? And I'm like, this was a beautifully shot film, right? And I would – the last thing you would – you know, this is what it'll get. They like all this – they talk about Grindhouse, right? And then if you saw New York Ripper in a Grindhouse, you would see it in a shitty-ass print, right? So, but on the Blu-ray, it looks fantastic. So, you know, Fulci was not the greatest director, but he could craft a good horror film, and he had a lot of his visual side was much better than his thematic side. And there was often a lot of great shots in a lot of his films. So, you know, I would rather see a good print of this film than be sitting in some grindhouse theater in the 70s or 80s in Times Square, which was a terrible place to be then, right? And,
yeah.
you know, I live
yeah.
and I live
yeah.
in New
well,
York.
You know, it's
I
just
live
like
in
people
York,
have
so.
Nostalgia for 70s and 80s New York, and I'm like, you know, or 70s and 80s, maybe 70s and 80s New York as a whole had more interesting places. You know, there were bookstores and theaters. You know, there was a whole different theatrical scene there. Culturally,
yeah.
it was very different. But when
but,
people
you know,
have nostalgia for Times Square in the 70s and 80s, I'm like, you're fucking insane.
Yeah, the people that get nostalgic about that era would never last 2 seconds there, you know? And what's kind of sad now is that Times Square is not completely going back to that way, but, you know, it's becoming a little bit less, much less safe. There's been a lot of shootings
yeah.
there lately, and, you know,
yeah,
I used to work.
You can still find some porn around the edges. Years ago,
yeah.
my then-girlfriend and I, we went there just for the hell of it, and because you know you don't go to Times Square to go there. You either end up there because you don't want to, or you go there on a lark. We went there on a lark, and we happened to see a porn shop, and we're like, "Holy fuck, these still exist here!" Thought Giuliani got rid of all of them. So we walked in. We immediately walked out because as soon as we stepped into the place.
Yeah.
Our shoes began sticking to the front door, the front
yeah.
walkway, and there was a smell of what can only be described as rotting fluids.
Yeah. And some people would say, like,
I imagine that somebody did something in a back booth, and instead of properly cleaning it up, they just mopped it all over the place.
Yeah, and somebody would say, like, oh, that sounds, like, really cool, man. It's like, not really. You know, I
no, no, trust me. The experience is the reality is bad. But this is digressing. So, Sydney, what about you?
Well, actually, I can kind of give some insight into that question because I actually, when the Grindhouse came out, I saw it with my father because he actually grew up on Grindhouse movies. And so I asked, what's the big deal with watching a movie that's, like, falling apart and you're missing pieces of it and all that stuff? And at least, so he didn't see them mostly in New York. He saw them in Miami. So for at least the way they had them there, it was the original, like, second-run theaters for them. That's how they saw a lot of sci-fi and horror, and they would do them double features, and they would shove them together. So for people that didn't have a whole hell of a lot of money, or they didn't have a lot of money because their parents wouldn't give them money to go see them, that was the only way they could see these things. So for them, it was nostalgia. And at least
yeah.
in Miami, it wasn't very porny in Miami, even though there's a lot of porn in Miami. Florida's like porn central outside of Vegas.
yeah.
I hate Florida, but like I don't know.
Anybody
I understood that. What?
No, I was joking. I don't want to offend any of our listeners in Florida. I was just saying, anybody with any sense hates Florida.
That's why I said it really fast. I was like, I hate Florida. But, like, for me, so the only reason, you know me, I love Planet Terror is it's my favorite movie out of the two. I do not like Death Proof. I think it's awful. So god awful, and it's true. The reason I have so many problems figuring out what my top three are is because every single time I think of Grindhouse, I consistently mistake Planet Terror as Tarantino's movie because I want it to be so badly because it's so good, but it's not. So it can't be in my top three. but I, whenever I rewatch it now, I just watch Planet Terror and I forget Death Proof exists. That's the way I like to think of it. Kind of like, for me, the third Godfather doesn't exist. Neither does Death Proof.
And okay, so now, Aaron,
I'll be happy.
Oh, yep. So, Aaron, your thoughts on Death Proof?
It's tough for me. It's easily Tarantino's worst film, but I went to see the whole Grindhouse thing. I went to see Grindhouse with my brother opening day, and it was, I kid you not, it was the best movie theater experience I've ever had. It was such a blast being there for like 4 hours with 300 people who all just want to have fun at the movies. It was so much fun. The trailers, the double feature, which you never get anymore. So separating that experience for me has been tough as I get further away from it. But as I mentioned earlier, Tarantino doesn't write movies. He writes novels and then directs movies. And Death Proof, I think, ultimately is a movie script, and I think it's a movie script with a lot of problems. I think the pacing's off. I think the characters are not that interesting, except for Stuntman Mike. It's basically, I mean, I think the best redeeming way to view it, other than Perry's My Worst Nightmare reading, which I think is an interesting take, which maybe I will keep in mind. I think the other interesting take is as an apology for the stuntman who died on the set of Kill Bill. But I think that ultimately I don't see this as a Quentin Tarantino film. I would be just as happy if he were to retroactively say, okay, I've only made 8 movies, and so I have 2 more left, because Death Proof was part of Grindhouse, which was something I did as an experiment with my friend Robert Rodriguez, and it wasn't really a Quentin Tarantino film.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let's hope that he doesn't end his career the way that some people have suggested he might, which is a remake of Reservoir Dogs. Now we are on to Inglourious Basterds. Now, this is a film that I love the first 20 minutes of. I think it has some brilliant stuff in between, but it's still not one of my favorite Tarantino movies, though it did go up a little bit when I revisited it back in June. So, Gregory, what are your thoughts on Inglourious Basterds?
Unfortunately, I have to pass again on this one. I've only seen a couple of scenes from it, and I've not seen the whole thing. So, go ahead.
Okay, so. So we'll go right to you, Sydney. What about you for Inglourious Basterds?
So, yeah, this is one of my top three, because my top three are Django, Inglourious Basterds, and Kill Bill 1. So this is, oh, God. There's so many reasons I love this movie. I mean, Christoph Waltz, that entire... Like, I believe this was, like, our big introduction to him as well.
Yeah.
So I think this Inglourious came out before Django.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Like, his entire bit, his entire character as a Nazi is so, that monologue. He's just great. Okay, I just love him, and I love his strudel bit later. Like, that was just, that was just awesome. But what my one of my favorite scenes in that entire thing is, I feel like this is going to come as zero shock to Adam. When the theater burns down with David Bowie played in the background, that's just a beautiful shot. It's just so beautiful. The visuals in that movie are what I feel like they're like his top visuals. And you can just put the movie on mute. And it's just a gorgeous movie to watch sometimes.
Yeah.
For a violent movie, like, that's saying a lot.
Mm-hmm. So, Perry, what about you?
If you strap me down and shoot me up with sodium pentothal and ask me what the best Quentin Tarantino film is, I'm probably going to say Inglourious Basterds. I think it's I will take him at his word with the last line of the film.
It might
so
be my masterpiece.
The monolith that is Pulp Fiction. But, oh, Inglourious Basterds has – I don't know of any film that is more drunk on the power of film than that film. There might be some that match it. But, I mean, literally, to the point that film itself destroys the Third Reich. It is such it is so watchable. I know that's an incredibly lazy verb to put on, adjective to put on it, but it is. Every sequence in it, it to me is absolute perfection. Even the ones that are just there to kind of mark some time. I don't know why we spend so much time with Mike Myers explaining why Michael Fassbender's in the movie, but I'm glad we do. I love that scene every time it comes on. I don't have any need to cut any moment from the film. And it is so, if Eli Roth, it's so good that if Eli Roth's best work isn't the Thanksgiving Day trailer, it's the German propaganda film within that film, which is such a great piece of drunken movie history. It's so good. It is exactly one of those films. And it is across the board brilliantly performed. Everybody in this movie is so good. Melanie Laurent is out of this world in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
She is so spectacular in that opening scene. And yes, that strudel scene is horrifying. Every time I see it, it is still so remarkably tense. And it's, you know, that is all due to, yes, very Hitchcockian like cutting on behalf of Tarantino, and a brilliant, brilliant performance by Melanie Laurent. It's really good, and yes, I'm gushing.
As much as I have issues with the movie, I don't hate the movie. I just have issues with it, and I actually just really, truly love some of the other movies a lot more. That's why, as I said, out of the 9 movies, I probably have it like around 7 or 6 or 7. But, you know, that doesn't mean I hate the movie by any means. I'm not going to go and call it his best work. But having said that, here's my caveat. I've long said that the Vito flashbacks in Godfather 2 are probably the best thing I've ever seen put on film. And similarly, I'm going to say that that opening section where we meet Hans Landa and we see that opening interrogation, everything from there to when the girl is running away, that opening 15 to 20 minutes may be the best sequence that Tarantino has ever put on film.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that one sequence make the movie for me? No. But it does keep the movie from you know, being one that I can look at and say, yeah, it's a bad movie, because, no, it's not. Aaron?
I love this movie. I think it is his best directed film. I think that Pulp Fiction still has an edge on it as an overall film, but I think this is where he really flexes his muscle as a director. And man, there's 3 what I would call heart attack sequences here. You have the opening interrogation. you have the strudel scene, and then you have the basement bar scene with Michael Fassbender.
Yeah.
And all three of those scenes, he just builds tension in a way, like, usually he just gives you the violence, or it's very straightforward in that way. And these, they really build the tension, the mood and the tone in this film are the atmosphere off the charts. Brad Pitt, sorry, has never been better. Brad Pitt as Aldo Raines is incredible. Christoph Waltz, what a find there. I mean, I know he worked in Germany a lot before this, but this was his American debut, and Take a Bow, Sir, and all the Oscars. I've heard your issues with them, and I think they're valid issues to be had. They're just things that I don't think really matter to me as a viewer. I think that this is just one of his truly great films.
Mm-hmm. So now we come to Django Unchained, a film that a lot of people seem to have mixed feelings on, at least the ones I've spoken to. I honestly think that this may be his best film. If it's not his best film, then it is his most maturely written film. I think it's the one where the concerns he poses in the script are treated with the most amount of intelligence and, dare I say, empathy. I think that there's a lot to be said for how you see the consequences of these actions. It's not rendered with the type of flippancy or judgment you see in some of his other work, but it's still definitely Tarantino. So you know what you're going in for. But again, you get another great Christoph Waltz performance, another great Tarantino script, and hell, what can we say about Sam Jackson in that role? Now, does anybody else here know the story that Sam Jackson told about when Tarantino handed him the script?
Yeah.
Okay. No, not heard that one.
Go ahead. Okay. Wait, are you talking about what he said to Leonardo DiCaprio or something else?
No. And I will tell it for Gregory, and I will tell it for you and for the audience that doesn't know. The story goes that Sam Jackson said, so Quentin said, I've got this new script. And he said, well, give it to me. Yeah, there's a role in it for you. You'll know which one. And so Sam Jackson read it, and he identified the character correctly. And he said, now you're telling me you want me to play, I'm not going to use the language he used, in the history of, and Tarantino said, yeah, why not? And Jackson said, I looked at him and I said, you motherfucker, of course I'm going to do it. But you're still a motherfucker for making me do this. And the interviewer asked him, well, how did he make you do it? He said, did you read the damn script? He said, you can't turn that shit down.
So he delivers one of the best lines in the whole movie.
So I will start with you, Gregory. What are your thoughts on Django?
Okay. I hate to say this again, that I've not seen the film all the way through, but I would like to bring up something that we spoke about on Facebook yesterday. Remember I had brought up the film Adiosio Tom, the film by Jaco Petty and Prosperity, the Gvando guys? And I think you've seen that film. And I was just wondering if there was anything from that film that, like, Tarantino borrowed from. Did you see that one? It was also known as Goodbye, Uncle Tom.
Yeah, I think I did.
Mm-hmm. But like I said, I've not seen the film all the way through, so you know I'll take another pass. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. So, Aaron, you?
This was quite the role he had here, with these two films back to back. First, he killed off the Nazis, and then he solved. Well, he didn't solve. American slaver. By the way, Leonardo DiCaprio in that film is so undervalued. Here you have your fresh-faced boy who has always been the hero or the love interest, just getting down and dirty. And, oh, he's terrifying in this film. He has such rage.
Mm-hmm.
Samuel L. Jackson as the house slave, the despicable house slave. And then Jamie Foxx, easily his best performance in Ray, possibly his best performance ever, though Collateral is also brilliant. Christoph Waltz with another Oscar win and another very deserving Oscar win here. It's definitely a very mature script. I said that Inglourious Basterds was his best directed film. I think this is his best written film. I think that he's very clear with what he's doing and why he's doing it. And all good German stories have mountains.
Yes. Well, why is there a mountain? Because it's a German story. There has to be a mountain somewhere. So, Sydney, what about you? Your thoughts on this one?
So, this is my all-time favorite movie of his. In fact, the day you asked me if I wanted to be on the podcast for Tarantino, I had just rewatched Django for, like, I honestly have to say, like, the 20th time since it came out. I just rewatch it all the time. It's so good. And, you know, oh, there's, like we said, Samuel L. Jackson is just, there's not really a role that you could give the man that he's going to suck at, let's be honest. And right before he dies, I'm going to edit it, but when he's like, oh, Lord, let me kill this expletive, like, that's just the throwaway line. Like, it's not much of a line, but to me, that's, like, the best line of the whole movie, just because of the way it's delivered, and it's Samuel Jackson, but
there's
just so much about that movie that's done well. Like he puts Jamie Foxx in a little boy blue costume. Like what was that? That was so cool. And then it's just gone, but it's just so well done. And Leonardo DiCaprio, like, I agree with you. He's not mentioned enough for that role. And I just, every time I watch it, and he cut his hand in the middle of the scene and he starts bleeding, I'm like, oh my God, that's talent. It's just, like, we've all known he was talented, like, since he was 13, but still, like...
Yeah, back when he did This Boy's Life, and De Niro came out of the first week of shooting and told Scorsese, hey, there's this kid, DiCaprio, that I'm working with, and you're going to have to work with him one day because he's going to be a big deal in this business. And De Niro wasn't wrong.
But I have to say, because we have to circle back to this, because, oh, my God, this movie is like, it's my top movie, but, oh, Jesus Christ. You get to the part with Tarantino and his god-awful Australian accent, and just, oh, it ruins it. It ruins it. Like, if I could just have someone else be in that movie in place of him, because that's the only part that just takes me out of the whole damn movie. It's like, I almost want to forget it. I'm so excited when he blows up. Not because he's a bad character, but just I'm so glad to see him leave and, like, get on with the movie.
Yes.
But Christoph Waltz, and I like how he was, like, he's a Nazi in the last movie, but now he's a bounty hunter killing slave owners.
Yeah.
Like, that's quite the shift. But I just...
So Perry, what about you on this movie?
It's the one I feel like I just don't get out of it as much as everybody else does. I felt that way at the time. I thought maybe at the time it was just expectations built up from how much I loved Bastard, but it's a very odd it feels like to me the one time where you see this weird mix of the what he has written on the page doesn't quite meld with the film he ended up making, because the story is Christoph Waltz's. He's the character that changes. That's the focus of the story. But what we see is this, you know, this fantastic birth of a black hero, of arguably the beginning of blaxploitation. That was probably what he was thinking when he conceived it, right? To have him cantering with the horse at the end is so showy, and it never coalesced for me. As well as some of the other movies, and that's not to say I don't think it's great. I think both of the movies he's doing are really interesting. I am not knocking the film for this. I'm talking about a reaction only, and the wind goes out of that movie for me after Christoph Waltz is gone. Like the rest of it just feels like, okay, we're going to do this too, but you already told the story, and so. So I've just been stuck with that every time I go back to it. And it's, yes, they're fantastic.
Yeah, I will say that,
great,
as much as I do love this movie, I do think it loses a bit when Waltz is gone.
And by the way, Sydney, yes, that sequence, it's not just Quentin. That whole sequence is terrible. It's such a waste of time at that point in the movie. It feels so long. It's so boring after what we've been through. Yeah, that's another reason I've always kind of had a problem with it's why it's not in the pantheon for me.
So now we move on to the next film, The Hateful Eight. Aaron, your thoughts on Hateful Eight?
It's long.
No, I like The Hateful Eight. But I just like it. It is long. It is very, like, British locked door mystery, Agatha Christie, or as Sydney put it earlier, The Thing retold in Wyoming without aliens. It's a movie I want to like more than I do, because I think there's a lot of really good elements in it.
Yeah.
I just don't think that it ever coalesces into a whole.
Mm-hmm. And now back to Sydney. So, Sydney, what do you think of this film? Is she still there? Sydney?
Sydney?
Uh-oh, did she get dropped?
No, she's still here. No, she did just drop off.
Okay.
She got raptured, folks. She just got raptured literally as I asked her, is she still there? So, she was having
trouble. The rest of us, we've been left behind then, huh?
Yeah, we've been left behind. So now, I will go to you, Gregory. What do you think of this one?
Well, first of all, I did actually see this one. You know, I did not see the previous three, and it's like, yeah, you're right. It is very, very long. It is too long, in my opinion. I think it runs like 3 hours without the intermissions or the roadshow stuff. I did not see in the theater in the 70mm. I mean, the DVD is obviously, and Blu-ray are obviously letterboxed. I watched it that way. And honestly, I don't understand why he shot it in that widescreen ratio. The only thing I can think of is Paul, as we know, Paul Thomas Anderson shot The Master not too long after, right around that same time, or actually before that, and he shot that in 70mm. And sometimes I think Tarantino was just trying to one up him in terms of presentation. But I did see the master in 70mm, and it was beautiful. I think it's actually Anderson's best picture, and the 70mm photography in that film is wonderful. It really enhances the picture. But in terms of Tarantino, he also shot it because The Master is shot in 1.85:1, which is a smaller aspect ratio, and a lot of people think that when it's a 70mm production, it has to be shot in like massive widescreen. That's not actually true. If you watch Playtime by Jacques Tati, that was 70mm, but that was framed at 1.85. So, you know, Anderson actually, because I think it was Rex Reed who complained that the film was small, was not widescreen, and that it had too many close-ups. Well, if you look at Lawrence of Arabia, that has some really famous close-ups, and that was shot in 70mm, and that was shot in like a 2:1.
Yeah, and actually, weren't some of the Ben-Hur or Lawrence of Arabia lenses that were used on Hateful Eight?
I think the Ben-Hur one was, yeah, because Ben-Hur was shot 2.75:1, just like this one was, yeah. And when I was watching it, I was just like, please, you know, it would have been better had he shot it in a smaller aspect ratio, like almost like an Academy ratio, you know. And I felt if he had cut it down and squeezed it, it would have been a really good film. And also the acting is like very mixed. Jackson's fine, Dern is fine. But I think Russell is a very good actor. I've liked him in almost everything. But he overacts in this film. Like, he's almost always he's yelling almost at all times. And I was like, why is he doing that? You know? And
yeah.
You know,
the person that actually really surprised me the most, and it probably shouldn't have, was Walton Goggins.
Was he the guy who played Shorty?
He's the sheriff.
The sheriff, yeah. So yeah, the film just felt very self indulgent, and you know, to bring back, is Sydney back or did she disappear?
No.
I think if you get dropped in the third hour,
she is permanently raptured, it looks like.
Okay, well, she mentioned about Tarantino's acting, and about halfway through this picture, he comes in with narration. You know, I want to help you all catch up, and I was like, you know, it's his voice, you know it immediately, and it's just, oh God, you know, even though he's not physically in the movie. You know that voice. It's just like, oh, dude, stop! You can't act, you know. Even though it's only a narration, but it's still just is very annoying. And I think that's pretty much it. But like, it could have been a better picture had it been like tighter and compressed, you know, into a smaller, you know, into a 1:33 Academy ratio to, you know, to enhance the intimacy. Now, you can be intimate.
Yeah.
You can show intimate, like, scenes in 70mm, as we've discussed. But I just don't think the 70mm works, even though there are some nice shots. It was shot by Robert Richardson, who's a fantastic cinematographer. So he does, yeah. And some of the interior shots, like in the barns, where you could see, like, snow all the way off to the right and in the background falling just gently, right? Just gently lit, and then in the foreground, you know, it's a beautiful composition. So there are some good stuff in the film, but just overall, I just thought it was just overindulgent.
And it does have that that really wonderful Ennio Morricone score.
Mm-hmm. Which was the only Academy
which he finally won his Oscar for.
Yeah, he finally got an Oscar. After what, doing like 75 scores, all of which were like brilliant. He should have won for every Leone picture he did. God.
Yeah, he should have won two or three for Leone.
Yeah.
Good, the Bad, the Ugly, Once Upon a Time in America, and probably Once Upon a Time in the West.
Absolutely. Or even the one Bertolucci's 1900 was one of his most underrated scores. That's a great score for that picture, you know?
You know, the thing is, I'm not a big fan of the movie, but the music isn't the problem.
Yeah.
So Perry, what about you?
When I'm watching it, I never want it to end. I enjoy it every time I see it. I remember seeing it the first time and thinking, I could stay here for hours. I could just hang out here and listen to these people talk. I am having a wonderful time. And it's probably the Tarantino film outside of Death Proof that I think about the least when I'm not watching it. I guess it's where he lets down just a little bit as a writer, and I don't know if it is just the massive length or if it is truly he hasn't quite connected all the dots. That ending just doesn't have the kick it's supposed to thematically. I don't really know what he's saying about American history and race relations.
Yeah.
And I am not one to be squeamish or to worry about these things on the whole, but I got to admit, the amount of physical abuse you watch Jennifer Jason Leigh's character take, however much she might deserve it, is, I will admit, kind of problematic. If for anybody who wants to have a problem with this.
Mm. It's very excessive. It is. It's very over the top. And I don't think it works. It doesn't work, you know?
She's fantastic. I think she's great in the movie. I think everybody's really good in the movie. It's actually, again, shoot me up with sodium pentothal. I think it's Sam Jackson's best performance in a Tarantino movie. Mm. I'm not saying it's the best part, but I think it's the best performance.
Yeah, he's subtle when he needs to be. He's over the top when he needs to be. You know, yeah, it is. There's a lot of shows a lot of range in that performance. But again,
I think Russell is so big to let everybody. I think he's playing straight man to everybody, and he knows it.
Yeah. So now we are on to Tarantino's last movie. And that is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So, Gregory, let's start you off.
Yeah, I just watched this a couple of days ago to prep for today. And, you know, my mother, who doesn't watch films like I do, I'm a filmmaker, film cinephile and all that, so I watch them naturally a little bit more intensely than most people, like all of us, you know, tend to do. But she was like, Gregory, they just drove around for 2 hours and it was boring and I fell asleep. So I had to rewatch, finish it the next day. And, you know, I think, and when I'm watching it, I'm like, yeah, she's kind of right. The film, we talked earlier about how the attention to detail in some of his films is really good. And the film looks gorgeous. It's beautifully shot, beautifully designed. You know, some great cinematography by Richardson. He got the period detail right. You know, he got all like the little, Cindy brought up red something cigarettes, right? Which I'm assuming
red
was
apple.
Brand back then. Red apple cigarettes.
No,
yeah.
it's Tarantino's brand. It's fake.
But I wasn't sure. Cause you know, I wasn't alive during that era. But it just drags for like an hour and a half. They're just driving around, and it just seems like all these vignettes that don't really connect at all, and they just seem to move too slow. I mean, it's not even really building like an atmosphere or nuance in the picture. And when it finally gets to when Brad Pitt picks up that hitchhiker and takes her to the camp, you know, the former like Western ranch, which is like a hideout for the Manson kids or the Manson cult. That scene is really good. The whole scene, it goes on for about maybe half hour, I think, and it could have been indulgent, but this time, even though it's a long scene, it's not indulgent at all. I think it's actually the best scene in the film. But yeah, the driving scene's just going forever. And the thing is, too, there's two songs in there that he misuses, in my opinion. One, Ramblin' Gamblin' Man by Bob Seger. You hear it when it's playing on the radio, right? Well, I think when Rick Dalton's or when Brad Pitt is driving, right? And now, it would have been an anachronism, but I think it would have worked if he had used the live version. The studio version of that song is very kind of dull, right? Seger was incredible live. He did a live album in the 60s, 70s called Live Bullet, which is considered one of the best live albums of that era, and rightfully so. And it's a much more dynamic performance, and his vocals are much more energetic. The studio version sounds really like, you know, almost like he's just going through it. You know, he's kind of stiff on stage. A lot of musicians are actually better live than they are, you know, in the studio because they're feeding off the audience, you know. They're feeding off the crowd. In studio, you just have your fellow musicians and some engineers and maybe some hangers-on. It's not really the same thing. And when the final bloodbath happens, you know, it's set to You Keep Me Hanging On by Vanilla Fudge, which is actually Vanilla Fudge's first album is one of my favorite albums like of all time. And that's a great cover of that song. I actually like it more than the original version. But it's such a powerful song. But he's not cutting to the music. It's almost like it's not playing. It's like you know what I'm saying? It's like when it hits like when Carmen Appice, the drummer, hits the drum, it's not cutting onto the music. It's almost like it's just in the background, and I don't think that it works at all. And when I see this ending, you know, even though it's a fantasy, I know that didn't really happen, you know. And then like you know, Rick Dalton hangs out with Sharon Tate, and it's like, well, what if this did happen? Well, first of all, it did not happen. And I don't know. It just feels like false. I mean, it is deliberately false. It is sort of maybe not an anachronism, right? That's probably not the right word, but I don't know. It just felt kind of dumb and insulting, you know. And then there was the whole Bruce Lee controversy. That scene. He's only in that film for one scene, and Bruce. If you ever watch interviews of Bruce, he was an extraordinarily thoughtful, articulate man. I don't think he would have been so, like, you know, like badass like that. He was a much more measured guy when you see him in interviews. So it is only one scene. It's not like – it's like – it only goes on for maybe 5 or 10 minutes. Maybe not 10 minutes, about 5. So overall, I would say a mixed film. It looks nice. It has, you know, some decent camera shots. Brad Pitt is really good. DiCaprio is good. The whole – fake controversy about Margot Robbie not having enough lines is a silly thing, right? She's luminous. She's Sharon Tate. She's luminous throughout the film. She doesn't need to speak that much, you know? So I would say a mixed bag.
Oh, yeah. No. And, you know, what was that? Now, I mean, I was thinking of another film where it made me think of that scene where the guy says, he won't shut up. And I kind of felt like that with this movie. As much as I did enjoy it, it was like, oh, my God. This movie doesn't end. I didn't think that it was interminable. I actually do think it's probably middle of the pack for Tarantino, but I think it absolutely has some pacing issues. But that said, we're really up against the end here. So, Perry, your take on this real quick, and then to Aaron for his take.
Absolute genius. I think it is. If Bastards is his love letter to film, this is his love letter to actors. DiCaprio has never been better in anything ever. From the fantastic stutter that sometimes appears and sometimes doesn't and is never explained or remarked upon, to that scene where he breaks down in tears because he gets the compliment from the kid actor is this wonderful. No,
oh, I love that little kid. She's awesome.
Actors.
Yeah,
that
the kid is. Yeah, I like
so
her too.
So good. That whole sequence is so good. It's such a love letter to actors, and then it's a love letter to L.A. in that time period. I think it's fantastic. I think it is the perfect marriage of Quentin as writer and Quentin as director. I think it's spectacular, and the wrong person got the Oscar.
Well, I honestly think that DiCaprio should have been up for the film, but he wasn't.
Mm. But this was Pitt's first Oscar, correct?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, this is Pitt's first. Well, his
so
first
it could have been like
As an actor. He had one or two as a producer, but yeah, that's neither here nor there. So, Aaron, your thoughts on this real quick?
Okay, real quick, Leonardo DiCaprio was up for the Oscar. He just lost to Joaquin Phoenix. I actually really enjoyed this movie. I think that it shows a more subdued and mature Quentin Tarantino. I think he's reflecting more on his career as he comes to the purported end of it. And I think it shows. I think that the film is very contemplative and very nostalgic, and sometimes that doesn't work, but usually it does. I think the controversy about Margot Robbie is asinine because I think she's the heart and soul of this film, despite the fact
that
she very rarely speaks. It's one I really, really like, but not quite love it. I think it's solid second tier, though.
Yep. And with that, I think that's it. Other than we didn't get to talk about his one scene he did in Sin City. This is it. I want to thank everybody for coming on. It was great. As always, thank you guys out there for listening. And I hate to rush, but we've only got about 2 or 3 more minutes before Blog Talk kicks us off, so we better wrap it up. So thank you guys for coming, and we will definitely do this again at some point. We'll get you guys on again for another director's chat or whatever. And on the count of 3, we'll say goodnight. 1, 2, 3,
goodnight.
Goodnight.